will call the meeting to
order, and we're speaking of order, we're going to vary from what's on the agenda. There's two bills that people have to be elsewhere shortly. And so we will start with House File 3123, Representative Morgan. And I would move that House File 3123 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3123 is a bill that will help streamline the consent requirements on the third-party billing process that right now is costing school districts millions and millions of dollars as they pay for health care services provided to students with IEPs in the schools. We believe that this bill is going to maintain the very important consent laws that are necessary as far as the exchange of data and information goes, but at the same time it will enable school districts to pass the costs of the health care they provide on to the insurance providers instead of taking it out of their general fund budgets that we all, of course, would prefer went into the classroom to educate the students. We are currently working with the Department of Human Services about on the language that's going to go on the forms and the consent and so forth. We don't quite have that finalized yet, but obviously we have deadlines looming, and we will continue to work with them to make sure that that the language works and is done in the most cost-effective way possible.
And Representative Morgan, it's my understanding there's no fiscal note on this.
That's right. As far as we know right now, there is no fiscal note. So, and we are continuing to work with them to make sure that it stays that way, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Representative Abler.
So, Representative Morgan, so if I get the drift of this, it just takes out the wasted process of getting denied before you bill Medicaid?
That's part of it, Representative Abler. There's also other roadblocks in the way of the information flowing, and this is designed to help make that information flow a little more smoothly.
Any other questions? Seeing none, I renew my motion that House File 3713 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. All those, what did I say, the wrong one?
3123,
yeah, sorry. Be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So that bill is sent off to the Finance Committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. And next we're going to hear House File 3010, Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know that my witnesses are here, so I think I can handle it, but I do think that the department may want to come up and chat a little bit. House File 3010 is a bill to allow volunteer firefighters to pay the full maximum premium into MnCare so that they have access to MnCare and health care coverage. This came from a report of a working group on Recruitment and Retention Task Force for Volunteer Firefighters and Volunteer Ambulance Personnel, which is also included in this bill, dated December 15th, 2006, report to the Commissioner of Public Safety. And it was cited as one of the things they would like to have access to so that they could use it as a retention and recruitment tool. This is very big to greater Minnesota folks, but also those of us that have paid on-call volunteer firefighters. With that, if the department wants to come down and talk about if there's fiscal implications for it. I'm very willing to work with them. I really would like to see this because I think it's another tool in the tool. I'd like to see this happen because it's another tool in the toolbox for our volunteer fire departments and ambulance service attendants.
Mr. Greenman, welcome back to the committee.
It's always nice to see a former coworker of mine.
Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. We did fiscal note this bill. We believe we put some program costs on it related to the premiums that the firefighters would be paying. The maximum premium for this particular group of people we calculated would not completely cover the cap rates, the capitation rates. We paid the health plans. So there would be some costs, as the bill's currently drafted, and there'd also be some systems costs associated with setting up a way to get these people enrolled and get them paying their premiums. But we did talk to Representative Bigham, and we'll continue to work with her on this.
I'm intending to lay this bill over for possible inclusion, so you have a week or two to work this out. Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I won't take up any more of the committee's time, but I just wanted to say a couple things. One, this is not a mandate. Like, they don't have to take this coverage. And the other thing is, I'll work with the department, because I really do, I want to find a happy medium and a cost-neutral idea for this bill, but I just want people to know that there is no mandate on this as well, and there'd be documentation sent to the department by the cities that, you know, they are qualified to be enrolled in this program. So I don't know if there'd be much more of a cost other than what they currently do, and there'd be no subsidy out of the fund for this. So that's all I wanted to say.
Representative Abler.
Well, thanks. And to that point, Representative Bingham and Mr. Greenman, on line 1.16, if it just said actual premium or something with that, get you closer, and you can work on that. But what kind of department costs would it be to enroll people? Is that what you're worried about? Is it $50,000 or $1,000 or?
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I believe the way we currently enroll people in Minnesota Care, we have a computer system set up so that we determine eligibility, we collect premiums based on income and assets, income. And family size, and this would be, in a sense, a new eligibility group, because they're not income eligible for Minnesota Care right now. So we would have to have a way of identifying that these are, in fact, firefighters, volunteer firefighters, I believe, and that they do qualify for the program, and that they qualify for the premium.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have that in the bill, though, because we have a form that they would fill out, and then they would have, you know, their person sign off on it and send it in. So I think I've covered that, but we can continue to work on it.
Well, thanks. Just the department, nothing comes easy, you'll discover. Good luck.
Right, thank you. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And my question is maybe along the same lines as Representative Abler's, and this tests my memory. Did we pass legislation to allow farmers or certain farmers into Minnesota Care? That weren't necessarily income eligible. Have we done this once, Mary Ellen Otremba's legislation?
Yeah, it was whether they can account depreciation in their income, I believe, was the problem there.
So is this the first time then, Mr. Greenman, that there'd be a group that's not necessarily income eligible, that we'd be setting up a form like this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I'm not sure.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Then I would renew my motion that House File 3010 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Next, I think we'll go to Representative Hosh.
He's not going to be here.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. House File 3686 is a bill that has come to us mainly because of dire circumstances for a clinic that's in the central Minnesota area that is called the Memory Care Clinic. And they work with not only individuals but entire caregivers and families for trying to treat and maintain issues related to Alzheimer's and dementia. It is a collaborative clinic that works with multiple different providers, and what I think does a wonderful service and could be a model for our future care of our aging individuals dealing with dementia and Alzheimer's. There's been many circumstances that brought us to this point for needing to look for some temporary one-time funding for the clinic. Instead of me explaining those needs and exactly what the clinic does, we have representatives from the memory care clinic here that would be happy to address the committee.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Sandy Wenner. I'm the executive director of the memory care clinic in St. Cloud. I want to thank Representative Hosh for making this opportunity available to us, and thank the committee. You have a handout, I believe. The first slide is just history of the clinic. I put it there for your information. I won't take the time to go over that at this point. We continue to have referrals. We've tracked where those referrals come from. And when I say referral, I'm talking about whole families, people with memory loss that usually turns out to be Alzheimer's disease or some other form of debilitating dementia. About 30% of our clients come to us from physicians. About another 30% come from families or self-referrals. Most of the families hear about us from talking with other families, and many of those families are in crisis when they come to us. They're in crisis because mom has set fire in the kitchen when she was cooking, or dad parked the car somewhere and walked home and reported it lost or stolen. You've all heard and seen the reports, the news reports of similar kinds of things. Those are the kinds of things our staff deal with every single day. The third page is just slide is an outline of what our clinic does on a day-to-day basis in terms of a comprehensive assessment. When someone is referred to us, we use the first part of the assessment to do a functional test of the person's ability to do everyday kinds of tasks. We use the everyday tasks, but use them in a way that tells us something about their thinking process, and it's predictable about how they will go about the rest of their lives, the things that they do every day. We have a psychosocial assessment by a clinical social worker that gives us an opportunity to find out what the family's needs are and be able to connect them to community resources. And the second part of our assessment includes a comprehensive medical history and physical exam by an advanced practice nurse. And out of that comes a family care conference where the family is able to say, okay, we've got a diagnosis, now what? And that's very often where families are left kind of high and dry and struggling. We're able to help them put the now what into steps that they can work with. In addition to that, we follow up with families on a regular basis, usually at 3 to 6 months, sometimes a year, and we're able to work with families over the 5 to 10 to 15 years that many families deal with this disease. We also provide caregiver support services in four ways. We provide caregiver education in groups throughout the central Minnesota area. We have support groups that are for both caregivers and the person with dementia. We do individual one-on-one counseling or coaching with individuals or with small groups. And we are involved with the Family Memory Care Program, which is a Board on Aging project that is studying the use of a protocol out of New York University in providing care to caregivers. It's an evidence-based program that is implemented in 12 sites around Minnesota. We'd like to be able to continue to do that. We have a role in education and training that I've outlined there for you, but I won't go into detail about it. So the goals of the memory clinic in the 5 years it's existed have been the early diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, the health and well-being of informal and family caregivers, assistance to primary care physicians in the care of their patients with dementia. And I think you all know that there's a coming shortage of primary care physicians. This is a way that we've been able to take some of the burden off of their plate and help them deal with this complex disease. We try to delay the institutional placement of patients with dementia by helping caregivers keep them at home and in their community as long as possible. We also provide education for caregivers, healthcare professionals, and the general public. I put out some statistics about the volume of our services. It doesn't look like huge numbers, but if you consider 400 patients, that's 400 families. Some of those families come in with one or two caregivers. In our area, there are lots and lots of families that come with 6 or 10 or 15 family members. And very often, all of them are sitting at the table with us. Over the course of the 5 years that we've been in existence, I've estimated that we've probably worked with 3,000 caregivers in some capacity. I have a chart there on the next slide that shows the growth in the clinic. The shorter numbers are the number of patients that we've seen. It looks like I created this chart because it's so even. The growth has been steady. We've had an increased number of patients every year. We've only tracked the caregivers for the past 4 years. The larger, the taller scales are caregivers, and again, we've seen that consistent growth. Overall, we've grown at about 25% per year, which is hefty growth for any business. The map page shows the counties. Does this show on the non-color? Yeah. The counties that we've had either patients or caregivers from. If this clinic fails, there will be a big hole in the center of Minnesota in dementia care services. In payment for patient services, in the 3 years that I've been with the clinic, we've become far more active in collecting co-pays and deductibles than they were the first 2 years that I was involved. We have provider agreements with Medicare, Blue Cross, Health Partners, all the major payers in Minnesota, including the Minnesota health plans. We've outsourced our billing system, so the bills actually get out the door now, which they didn't in the first few years. The thing you should know about this is that insurance does not fully cover the cost of providing the comprehensive care that we provide. It's the care planning, the sitting down and working things through with families that takes our staff time, but the health care system as it is now does not yet reimburse us for that. Our funding for caregiver support services comes through the Older Americans Act on a contract through the Central Minnesota Council on Aging. That's partial funding for caregiver services. The Minnesota Board on Aging provides some funding for our involvement in the Family Memory Care Program and is also funding our support of mentoring another program in nearby Cold Spring. We continue to need patient or caregiver contributions, donations, and grants to fund those unfunded costs. And that may be something that we'll always have to look for some additional funding. I feel that this program is important for the future of healthcare in Minnesota. The way that we have set up our program, we know that we have almost all of the components in place for a medical home. With the exception of the primary care physician. We feel that in working with in a closer relationship with primary care physicians, it would not be very difficult to set up a medical home for families caring for Alzheimer's patients in Minnesota. The Family Memory Care Program is an evidence-based practice that's known to delay nursing home placement. We'd like to be able to continue that program. We've also had some experience with other evidence-based programs like the Stanford Chronic Disease Management Program, and we're looking at powerful tools for caregivers for next year. We'd like to have the opportunity to continue that. We know that there was a 2009 legislation initiative to return people to the community from nursing homes. If any of those people are people with mild cognitive impairment or early onset Alzheimer's disease, we are in a position to help those families take care of their own and connect them with the community agencies that they will need to maintain them in the home. We also know that there are some changes coming to readmissions and ER visits, repetitive ER visits for people. There will be, it'll be difficult for hospitals to readmit. This program is one that can help families avert those crises that land people in emergency rooms and hospitals. In all, I think this program is ahead of the curve in terms of the health care reform, and we're struggling because of it. The next slide is one that maybe is a little hard to look at, not in color, but if you look at 2005, the biggest piece of the pie was in-kind. That was the agencies and the volunteers and the clinics that put their heads together to create this program. The smaller piece of the pie, the dark pie in 2005, was the initial grant funding that came through DHS and the CSSD system. Is that a familiar term? CSSD. If you fast forward to 2009, the lightest section of this is now our in-kind. In 2010, it will be a very small sliver. The second lightest one on the upper left is our donations and private grants. 2 years ago was the first time we ever did any fundraising in our community, and in 2009 we doubled what we had done before. The darker section on the upper right is our grant funding at this point. And the darkest section on the lower right is our third-party reimbursement. We've gone from zero in 2005 to that teeny little slice in 2006, a bigger slice in 2007, a nice dark chunk in 2008, and really a quarter of our budget in 2009. And I suspect it'll be more in 2010. This is our current situation. Because of the growth in health partners, where we were officed before, we lost our in-kind office space in September. We also lost the volunteer medical director that we have. We're working with a local psychiatrist who is providing us a few hours a month, but it's not free anymore. And we were unable to get any CSSD funding last year. So the last few months, it really has been a blessing in that it's forced us to work a little harder and increased our productivity. We're much more efficient than we were a couple of years ago. We've reduced our staff somewhat, doubled our fundraising, as I said, and implemented some administrative efficiencies that were needed. At this point, we're close to the break-even point, but we're not there yet. What would happen?
Mr. Chair, without any help at this point, the memory care clinic would be closing probably in the next couple months, if not the next month. And that's the urgency of the situation right now. I've worked with the memory care clinic from associations and colleagues that I've had, and I'm seeing the good work that they've done. They approach the situation not simply as a medical approach, but one of involving an entire family in a therapeutic approach, not only for the individual, but the family that wants to give care to somebody dealing with cognitive disorders, but doesn't know how. And that's the direction that we really need to go as a state, because we know with the demographic shifts that this challenge is only going to become greater and greater. What I've been most impressed with is the diversity of funding sources for the memory care clinic, from zero private pay, third-party reimbursements to about 25% this year, and they're moving into a direction of greater sustainability with their funding sources, but want to make sure that we can give them that one last push that will allow them to remain open, and they do anticipate solvency in the next year. But without any help, the consequences, I think, will be long-term, because if the memory care clinic closes, I think there'll be initiatives as early as 1 year from now to try to build something back up from the ground up, and that's not efficient, and it's not the direction that we want to go in central Minnesota. So I'd be happy to take any questions and urge the committee support.
We have two signed up, but before we get to them, is it Ms. Wenner?
Yes.
What medical services do you provide that you can bill the third-party payers?
We have an occupational therapist that does an assessment and care planning. That's billable. We have a clinical social worker that does an assessment and is involved in care planning. Planning is billable. And we have an advanced practice nurse who is currently a clinical nurse specialist, and that service is billable. What we have the hardest time getting paid for is the care planning that occurs in the care conference, where we sit down with the family and nail down the steps that need to be done.
Well, you might want to hang around for Representative Thiessen's got an amendment to my bill that deals with medical homes, and one of the things that the feds are very interested in is expanding this outreach to families. Mm-hmm. So the federal laws may change, and it may help your situation.
That's what I'm thinking, and I have a slide in there that says, you know, something about future funding. I do believe there are some things coming down the pike, both in federal legislation and here, that will cover some of that chronic care management. And our clinic is in a position to take advantage of that as they come along.
Okay. We won't have Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for telling us your story. This is wonderful, and sounds like you're really doing a good service there. I just am curious, and maybe DHS would know, is what type of a process we have for groups like this that would like to have some help in funding. I'm wondering, how do we typically give a grant of $100,000 to somebody? Is there a competitive process, or is there a way that other people can ask for the same types of money?
In the past, we've applied for and gotten CSSD money, the Community Service Development monies. I believe it was 4 years that we had that funding. We did put in an application last year and did not receive the funding that we asked for. Now, last year was kind of an unusual year. We were homeless and asked for some funding for an office renovation and furnishing, and that was tossed out in the very beginning because they were not taking any building-type projects. The other thing we really need fairly soon is an electronic medical record and billing system.
Mr. Chair, if I can respond to this too. The memory care clinic has kind of gone through a perfect storm of setbacks. The loss of the the grant funding was one that most likely would have been able to be absorbed on its own. But the Health Partners building moved. We actually provided bonding money for the technical college to take over the space that the memory care clinic was in and had an in-kind office space. Now no longer has that. So you had the rent that had to be due also. And then they also lost their physician director. That was an in-kind contribution. So for those three things to happen all within 1 year has brought us to this point. The funding model or the revenue model shows that they're moving in a direction of sustainability. We just need to get through this one bump.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Hosh, I appreciate you bringing this forward. I signed on to this bill. Members might recall that I brought forward the Alzheimer's Working Group bill last year. We are way behind in dealing with the memory disorders, the dementia cases that are going to be coming down the road here not too long from now as our baby boomers age. Minnesota's not ready for it, and Central Minnesota cannot afford to lose this memory clinic. I'm convinced that they are obviously moving in the right direction financially, but keep in mind this is the only facility of its kind in the Central Minnesota area. We need more of them. Representative Hosh is absolutely right. We need these kinds of approaches to not only taking care of people with memory needs, but their families, the caregivers who are going to be taking care of them in the future in other settings. So I'm very much in support of this bill, and I know we've got other testifiers as well, but wanted to make sure I got that on the record.
Okay, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hosh, in the bill, it calls for a 50% match. Do you have that match ready to go?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, when looking at the in-kind contributions and the donations, yes, about $125,000 the clinic is able to raise through personal grants or other donations through other nonprofits or whatnot. So we think this falls well within that guideline.
Representative Hayden.
Just kind of a quick question, Mr. Chair, Representative Hosh, and Ms. Winters. I'm a little concerned. I mean, obviously you need the clinic and we're going that way, and it sounds like you've done a wonderful job. I'm just worried about the sustainability, and you touched a little bit about that on potential federal or even state changes in regulations, but it sounds like you've had a tough time up to this point and are on the kind of brink of closing, and even if we were able to give you this grant and you were found the match, what is the long-term prognosis in terms of you being able to keep your doors open, or I'm concerned that you'll be back here next year, quite frankly.
Mr. Winter.
A couple of things we're doing is we have talked with the two major health systems in our area about either absorbing us or cooperating with us or engaging with us on a more on a closer level, whether that's office space, whether it's working closer with physicians. I don't exactly know how that will work because it's in the beginning stages. But one of the things we do know, because we had a volunteer who's sitting behind me that did a survey of memory clinics throughout the United States. And what we know about the successful memory clinics is that they are parts of larger healthcare systems or university systems. And I believe that we would be most successful in that kind of a setting. We haven't been able to get the health systems to even look at us until now because we weren't making enough. We didn't have enough income. Now they're looking at us and saying, oh, you can bill? You know, and yes, we are billing, and we are getting paid with the exception of a few codes.
Okay, Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for testifying. And this may be, I don't know, more rhetorical, but I'm wondering if memory care, if that's defined in statute, because it sounds like what's happening is the policy hasn't caught up to the practice, and I don't know if that's something we need to be looking at as a committee, or maybe you can shed some light on that.
No answer.
Okay, well, I think it's a new entity, obviously. It sounds, and I know I've seen them around in my community as well, and I don't know how we are dealing with them, you know, as policymakers in general.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hodge.
Mr. Chair, Representative Root, I think you're absolutely right, and I think what we did in, I believe, 2008 with the health care reforms and the medical home model is something that really falls in line with what the memory care clinic is doing. It's a medical home. It's not just teaching the individual, but also the support system around them, how to best provide care and support for the individual, whether it be the physician or the family or other community supports in that person's life. So our policies are, I believe, with the medical home model that we're trying to pursue, are trying to catch up, but aren't there yet.
Okay. And Ms. Winter, do you do outcome measurements to see if you actually are keeping people out of the hospital, that sort of thing?
We need a researcher to do that. We do know some things, and I'll tell you what. Some of the testing we use is on a scale of 1 to 6. The CPT test, which is a test that the OTs use, is on a scale of 1 to 6. Presumably, most of us in this room are 6. People at the 1 level are pretty much reflex only. They're barely alive. Most people enter nursing homes at around 4.3, 4.5, that kind of thing. We have a large number of families that are caring for people who would test out at, and do test out because we see them every 6 months, at 3.3, 2.8, 2.9, 3.2. When we know that most of the people that receive this testing when they go into a nursing home on admission are about 4.5, 4.3. Is that accurate, Joan? So we have that information. We've not had a researcher who is able to put it in. I'm not a researcher. I'm the one who runs the office. But I recognize the need for that.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Hosh, I think you did not move your bill at the start, so why don't you move that? And
I'll move 3686, Mr. Chair, to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair, just for the record, too, we've got we actually have the St. Joe guy working with the St. Cloud guy. So we've got, the other night you mentioned the St. Cloud guy, and Representative Hodge took offense at that, but here we've got it kind of in reverse. That's a good thing.
It doesn't match the narrative I gave yesterday, does it, Mr. Chair?
Okay, well, thank you very much, and keep up the good work. Next, we're going to have House File 3269, Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You want to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move my bill, and then I also have a delete all amendment.
Where's the delete all? Oh, there it is. Okay. Representative Bunn has moved House File 3269, and she has moved the DE2 amendment, which is a delete all and gets the bill the way she wants it.
And, Mr. Chair, I have an oral amendment to the delete all, one word.
Well, yesterday we had a man that just added one letter.
Yes, right. on line 3.27, the delete all, strike or and put in the word and. 3.27 after the word department.
Okay, so she's Representative Bunn has moved on line 3.27 to strike the word or and insert the word and. And any other discussion of the amendment? Okay, well, all those in favor of the DE2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So we have the DE2 amendment as amended before us. Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know several of you have heard this presentation in the Health Policy Committee, so I'll make it brief today. The amendment changes were primarily small changes related both to some technical wording on the add-backs, but also in the other parts. But let me just give a brief history. Last session in the original proposal from the governor, all adult dental benefits for our public programs had been zeroed out. And so it was the task that I took on to try to restructure and restore a set of dental benefits for adults in Minnesota on these programs, but that would be at a significant cost savings of what we had before while still supporting medical necessity across these activities. That was the task that I worked on with a number of stakeholders. We met over many weeks during that session and came to some decisions about a structuring of an adult dental benefit set, the first time we actually spelled this out in state statute. So that was passed last session, applied to both medical assistance and Minnesota Care. Then at the end of last session, further affecting this area is the governor unallotted the critical access dental boost payment for medical assistance, but kept it under Minnesota Care, which further impacted many of these areas we had been working on. So at this point, and when we came into this session, there was two concerns raised. One is the funding for critical access dental care generally, as the governor's new proposal further pared back that program, both who was involved and in that program. But also there had been concern developing in the dental community, particularly those serving the disabled and the elderly in the dental community, that some of the cutbacks we had taken on may have gone a bit too far. And we were aware of that at the time that we made them, but we knew what budget challenges we had going forward, that we had gone fairly far in some areas. But after some of the implementation and further evaluation of the impact of these, there was concerns that particularly in two or three areas that we needed to add some things back to them. So what you have before you in this, and I'll work off the delete all, is a bill that has three elements. First is we have a list in section one of areas in which we've made some modifications to the dental benefits. Not that we're restoring all these categories, but restoring some aspects of them, particularly the lead ones being of concern having to do with repairs of dentures and also having to do periodontal work, particularly with developmentally disabled and at-risk populations. So I will let you take a look at that list, but I have some dentists that today that will be commenting on various aspects of it. We also adjusted further what kinds of sedations could take place in an outpatient setting for dental procedurals and oral dental procedurals. Secondly, the other element of this bill was the issue of restricting who can become a critical access provider, and this is dealt with in Section 2. Under the governor's proposal this year, there's a very serious restriction that occurs. It does save us significant money, but it limits it to a very small number of clinics in Minnesota, primarily community clinics, low-income clinics. It excluded things like the University of Minnesota dental clinic and other training centers for our dental students, including outstate ones that serve 80 to 90% percentages of underserved populations and public program people. So we also have a proposal here in Section 2 to further restrict and to find some savings, but not as restrictive as that involved in the governor's proposal. And so you see that in Section 2, assuring that the major critical access providers that have been operating at the university and in their outstate clinics, also some very large providers that served over 10,000 people in this program, could continue to serve and more. And but we did restriction by in the past. You only had to have 20% public program by policy, but we now have taken that up to 40%. And this is the part that would have brought some savings, this and other aspects, into the program. finally, the third section, and this was discussed last year and then abandoned when we couldn't quite come to agreement at the end, was the agency had asked for some clarifying language as to designating a termination in terms where there's been fraud and various kinds of abuse. And so this, and also expected this to save money as well going forward. So in an effort to both have accountability and to clamp down fraud, but also to save money going forward, we have included language in this area as well this year. So these are the three main sections. We did receive a preliminary fiscal note just today, so just only had it for a couple hours. We knew that when we started doing add-backs that we'd have increased cost, some add-backs of cost. We had no idea how much, and we certainly didn't know by category how much. So one of the things we were looking for with getting a fiscal note in this bill was to find out by type of add-back, dentures versus periodontal versus other things, what that would be costing us for these programs. Unfortunately, while there's a lot of numbers in the fiscal notes, even this economist hasn't made heads or tails out of it yet. And the main thing that we are looking for, which is a more detail on how much each of these add-backs costs, is not contained in this fiscal note. I have spoken to the department, and we are working on a meeting for tomorrow or as soon thereafter to go into the detail behind this to determine what each of these add-backs is costing. So as expected, we have on the fiscal note, and it should be in your packet, we have increased cost of $4.4 million in the fiscal year 11, followed by smaller increased cost of $1.14 million, and then $767,000 the two out years. Why is so much in the first bit year is because also a fourth piece of this bill actually was to restore some of the unallotment. So we had put in this bill a restoration of about $3 million of what I think overall was about a $6 million unallotment. And so that's why you get this big, huge number in the first year. So obviously that can be up for discussion as we go forward with our fiscal decisions. But mainly just to let you know that my task going forward and working the department and stakeholders to find out exactly what each of these add backs was costing in this fiscal note. You'll also see in the note that there's most of the savings is in booked in the Healthcare Access Fund and most of the cost in Minnesota medical assistance. And that's because much of these add backs will affect the elderly and disabled, and most of that's on the MA side of things. So that's why you're seeing it work out that way. And again, I would like to get greater understanding of how that works and the assumptions of the FISTI notes. So I think our goal here was to get this information. We need even more detail than this to make our final decisions as this goes forward. And so we'll be working to do that. I think our original view in trying to, with this project, was to come up with something relatively revenue neutral between the add backs and the increased savings from limiting the program further, putting aside the allotment issue. And so that is still our goal, but we do believe that some of these add backs are absolutely essential for health for some of these populations, so we'll be looking to do some of those. So be glad to take questions I have with me, though, before that. I know there's other testifiers as well, but I brought in Dr. Helgenson with me, who works with Apple Tree Dental and serves a lot of these populations. Last at the health policy session, we had this DVD we showed a clip from of the impact on some of these populations, but today he'll testify in person about some of these issues.
Great. Thank you.
Dr. Helgenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Dr. Michael Helgeson. I'm the CEO of Apple Tree Dental. Many of you know that Apple Tree is a nonprofit organization, and we're one of the state's designated critical access dental providers, and we serve children, adults, elders in the Minnesota public programs in five regions of the state, up in northwestern Minnesota, the greater Twin Cities area, south central Minnesota, and the Rochester area. So the critical access program and being able to continue providing services to the state's most vulnerable population is obviously a very high priority for us. So I'd like to very briefly address a few key questions and then highlight a couple of key points related to the bill. First, why is preserving the critical access dental provider program the top priority for the Dental Access Alliance, which is a group of almost all the dental stakeholders, and recently by the Dental Services Advisory Council formed by the Department of Human Services? Why is maintaining this program absolutely the top priority? The reason is pretty basic, and that is that this is the single most successful program in 25 years in maintaining and strengthening the state's dental safety net. Without that program, roughly 40% of the services that are currently delivered could be lost. So it's really critically important, and many of the organizations involved are the only source of care for the various population groups in question. So if they're gone, there is no other alternative clinic or program that's able to serve them. Clinics will close. Dentists will leave the program. And it could take a decade or more, in my opinion, to rebuild the infrastructure of the dental safety net if critical access funding for medical assistance isn't restored. Again, thousands of people could lose their only source of care, and as I think most of us know, we've certainly been talking about this the last few years, mouth infections, unlike other types of infections, are not self-limiting. So to not fund the prevention and early treatment of mouth infections doesn't save you money. Those infections spread, you have higher dental costs, and you have higher medical costs for diabetics and others who have problems that are complicated by having an untreated chronic infection in the mouth. This is especially true of adults with disabilities and frail elders who can often get tipped into a hospitalization scenario if they have untreated infections in their mouth. So it's not really saving money. I think we have to look at, you know, we're spending healthcare dollars to get people healthy and keep them healthy. And dental is one of the best investments in that area. So it's really a false savings when you don't book back the long-term costs of not covering these things. Well, what else could be lost if the critical access program isn't adequately funded? The critical access providers are some of the most important innovators in the state, developing new ways to serve unique population groups and really triggering changes that are essential in the delivery of health care. And a lot of that leadership can be lost if that infrastructure goes away. And how long will it take to build that kind of a leadership back? These are incubators for change. And we all know we need changes in the healthcare system to deliver care better at a lower cost and get better healthcare outcomes. So what are some of the key reasons that this bill is so important? For me, the restoration of the governor's unallotment of funding for medical assistance critical access is the single most important aspect of this bill. For critical access providers, medical assistance is the vast majority of their patients. Mm-hmm. Minnesota Care enrollees are much more mainstreamed into other kinds of dental offices. So having critical access funding for Minnesota Care only, which is the status quo, doesn't help solve the problem at all. We've already worked last year on cuts to dental benefits, including the limited adult benefit set, which are a 20% cut or more for funding for the dental community. That's a huge cut. And when you add unallotment of medical assistance to that, you're approaching a 50% cut for many organizations, which literally is the sink versus the swim level of funding. So I think that's absolutely essential. How does the bill enhance accountability? I think the new designation and termination language will help improve quality for providers. It will give the department some tools that it feels it needs. The relationship between this bill and the Dental Services Advisory Council creates a forum where all the dental stakeholders can get together and help establish guidelines based on evidence that will move the whole dental delivery system in the right direction. How is patient care directly improved? Certain dental services that weren't included last year have been added back, and I think that's really critical. You know, we have two main infections in the mouth. We have cavities, which infect teeth, and we have periodontal disease, which infects the gum and the bone. There was not any coverage for periodontal disease in the first version of the limited benefit set. So now there is at least limited coverage for periodontal disease. That's critical. People with dentures in the earlier version, if they broke their denture or if they lost weight and couldn't wear their denture, you know, what are they going to do? Wait 6 more years before they can chew? So some key benefits were added back, and I salute Representative Bunn and all the other stakeholders that have worked really hard to try to find what are the essential services that we really must have. Let's not ask for everything. Let's just ask for what's essential, and let's add that back. So I think those are some really important things that will make a difference in people's lives. So how is spending reduced? The new standards for critical access designation double the minimum percentage of public program patients in a practice that are needed to be designated as critical access. And that's going to limit how many critical access providers there are in the program. And that should help reduce costs. And that's not, in my view, that's not desirable. It'd be great to maintain all, but what we must do is focus the dollars to sustain the most essential core by tightening that circle. And I think this language takes a step in that direction of really making sure that each organization designated meets some tighter new standards. So just in summary, I want to thank Representative Bunn for her tireless work, and it really is tireless. How many meetings we've had and how many things have been discussed have been very impressive, and I think it's extremely important to maintain the healthcare safety net by supporting the Critical Access Dental Provider Program. So thank you for the opportunity, and I'd welcome any questions.
Are there any questions for Dr. Helgeson? We have two other people signed up to testify, but Representative Ruth. Okay, why don't we have the other two people, Barb Jacobson and Dr. Richard Marlowe.
Hello, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Barb Jacobson, the Chief Operating Officer at ARM. We represent providers of services to people with disabilities, and we're here to vigorously support this bill. With the possible reduction and or elimination of state-operated dental services, the individuals that are served by the people we represent are even more limited. We have a challenging population. It's a nearly impossible to get into a community dentist, and will be even harder should this bill not go forward. As you know, the people we serve have challenging medical issues as well as behavioral issues, and the amount of time it takes to provide service to these people is much longer than it would be for an average adult individual in the community, and so it's just a great challenge to find someone who's willing to do services. This results in providers having to drive long distances, so we're taking people with compromised medical conditions, increased behavioral needs, and putting them in a car for 2 or 3 hours in order to find dental access dental services. That's a one-way trip, so it's basically a day-long trip. When we talk about costs and savings and things that offset each other, I think everyone knows that poor dental health results in pain for many people, and for the individuals that are served by our providers, this manifests itself in behaviors that sometimes we can't figure out why there's an aggressive situation going on, and it comes down to it being a dental concern. Increased behavior results in increased costs due to increased needs for staffing and sometimes even crisis services for people because things get out of control. So again, I vigorously support this bill on behalf of ARM, and thank you for your time.
Okay, let's go to Dr. Marlowe.
Yes, thanks. My name is Rick Marlowe, and I'm a oral and maxillofacial surgeon in Mankato, Minnesota, and we're one of the oral and maxillofacial surgery is one of the 9 specialties of dentistry, and as such, a big part of our training is being trained in anesthesia. I trained at the Mayo Clinic, and here in Minnesota, we also have the University of Minnesota, but in our residency programs, we're trained in anesthesia on the anesthesia service, and it doesn't look like anybody here is quite old enough for this, but if you had come to the Mayo Clinic in the late 1980s to, say, have a kidney transplant, I might have done your anesthetic as an anesthesia resident. So that's our training, and we have very rigorous guidelines by our national organization and our state society as far as what we need to do to provide this service. And I work with colleagues of Dr. Helgeson at the Apple Tree Clinic. I think it's in Adelia.
Yep.
And I think a key thing to remember is that the 2 most common diseases in the world are dental decay and periodontal disease. And, you know, anesthesia was invented in the early 1800s, mid-1800s, by dentists originally. And before that time, life expectancy was in the age of 30 to 40 years. And the reason is people would get a dental infection, could not be treated, and they would become septic and die, you know. And so it goes to the very foundation of what we do in dentistry, and particularly in oral surgery. And so I really appreciate the efforts that Representative Bunn has done to put the ability of oral surgeons to provide anesthesia in this amendment, is what it's called, rather than the rule that was created January 1st, which said we had to take the patients to the hospital, which drastically increases the cost, drastically decreases access, and actually increases anesthetic risk for most of our patients. So I don't have any prepared remarks other than to say that and to thank Representative Bunn and my own Representative Terry Morrow for helping with this. So,
okay, we have some people with some questions, but I just sure. Last year we had testimony from Dr. DeAngelis, who's the head of dentistry at the Hennepin County Medical Center.
Okay.
And I asked him, what's the interaction between diabetes and dental care? And he said, well, let me tell you about a gentleman that came into our hospital last summer with a very bad toothache. He said because he that complicated with his diabetes, he said he spent 3 months in the hospital, cost $400,000, and the gentleman lost half of his face and half of his chest because of a toothache.
Right. Mm-hmm. And there are many, many, many more people that we treat in our offices with general anesthesia because that's the only way we can do the procedure. We can't, many people, we cannot get numb. And quite honestly, I mean, I think probably everybody here knows someone or can identify with this, but fear is a big impediment to getting dental care. And to suddenly take away our big ability to alleviate that was just devastating. And we all have anecdotes about patients, but about a week or so before I first wrote Representative Bunn, I had a patient who had the medical assistance. She had a badly infected tooth. It needed to come out. But the problem with infections is they lower tissue pH, and the local anesthetics that we use only work within a narrow pH range. And if you get above or below that, it doesn't matter how much local they get. They're not going to get numb. And I kind of explained this to her, and she did not have the funds to go to the hospital, and certainly the hospital doesn't have the operating time, you know. So she elected to take some antibiotics and try to quiet this down a little bit. And Dr. Helkson's right. You dental infections, you have to remove the source. You can't treat them with antibiotics and cure it. So anyway,
Representative
Fritz. Very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is my question is for Dr. Helgeson, the Apple Tree Dental. And my question again, and I think I've asked this of you before when we first started this, is about my nursing home residents out in greater Minnesota who are still waiting for a dentist. And in the nursing home industry, in the nursing home that I worked at, they went to Blooming Prairie from Faribault, which is less than 60 miles. I see you have a 60-mile radius in the bill, but I was hoping that you had some information to share with me, some good information.
Well, we would certainly love to provide services in Faribault. We launched our program in Rochester about a year and a half ago, and there's a tremendous demand in the Rochester area. I would have to say that our ability to even sustain our current program is quite threatened by this unallotment of medical assistance critical access funding. It's a 30% cut on top of a 20% cut for the elders. And so it's about a 50% cut, which, you know, it's very, very difficult. We are working on some alternative payment mechanisms to try to offset that, but we have not been able to fully implement that yet. So we're struggling right now with 3 or 4 months of services delivered with very little actually coming in on the revenue side, which we can't really sustain that for very long. So it's getting critical for us to get this funding restored for critical access. But once restored, then, yes, we would be prepared to expand services there.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. A follow-up to that, I would be remiss if I did not also include my director of nurses from Northfield in their nursing home settings as well, because it's been 40 years we've been waiting, and yeah, we'd like to get you in there. Thank you.
And you are on our list.
Thank you.
Representative Root.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just a comment. I just want to thank the testifiers for being here, and really want to thank Representative Bunn for the work that you've done on this. And I signed on to the bill. We are all we're faced with some really horrible choices this year, and it really is, we are all very fortunate to have such a diligent legislator who is willing to go through this line by line, like Representative Murphy did with the GAMC bill. And I just wanted to thank you and publicly, and I think in the ideal world, we wouldn't be making any of these cuts. I think all of us who have dental care are so fortunate because, you know, I grew up, my dad was a dentist, so I'm not afraid of the dentist, but there's a lot of fear out there, and it's horrifying to think that there are going to be people out there who won't have the access and care that they need. So hopefully we'll be able to keep moving in the right direction with this and addressing the needs that the people have out there. But I just really wanted to thank you for your hard work on this.
And Representative Bunn, the dental director from Health Partners, was in my office this morning, and he was also very complimentary to the work that you've done. Mm-hmm. And with that, we will take... Does she move the lid on here? House File 3269 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the
as amended.
Omnibus bill. As amended. And Representative Bunn, why don't you just stay there and do House File 677.
I have to get my other file.
But this is going to have to be very brief.
We'll make this one brief, and I don't think we'll even have testifiers on this one today. This is the body art licensing bill. Members, this bill has evolved over some work over many years where people attempted to come to an agreement about licensing body art establishments and technicians. Originally, they were just talking about mostly tattoo artists, but also body piercers. The purpose for this bill is twofold. First of all, there's a huge public health purpose behind it. The issue was brought to our attention by the Red Cross, the North Central Region Red Cross, and the blood banks in terms of the issue that currently, that because of national policies, that if a person has been tattooed or pierced in the last 12 months, currently they are not able to give blood in Minnesota. The only way they could is that there's some sort of statewide licensure for body art. So that the first purpose is to address that issue. We have an aging population, and one of the many effects of that is that people are more diseased, and so the fewer of them can actually give blood, qualify to give blood. At the same time, on the younger end of the spectrum, we have much more mainstreaming of body art today, and so people have more of this done. So at both ends of the demographics, we have reduced the ability of people to give blood, and so this bill is an attempt to have that statewide licensing so folks that have been pierced or had tattoos can continue to give blood even within that 12-month period. The second major purpose of the bill is that the body artists, at least the ones that we have been able to work with relationships with in the past many months, want this legislation. They want regulation of their industry. They're very proud of the traditions they have and what they do. They're very proud of the health and safety standards that they have in their establishments, particularly in the areas which have had local licensure for some time, and also those who have very professional operations in our state. And they're concerned about those that aren't as professionally done and the risk to the population. To the public from not engaging in appropriately sanitary conditions. So both that we have worked for months to have a bill that everyone would be happy with a great deal of input from the artist community. It's a challenging bill because we don't have very established associations of these artists in our state. They're a tradition of more independence and do not have schools. It's done in a more informal way. So it's an unusual type of licensure when you don't have very organized professional associations coming to you asking to be regulated in that way. So we have reached out to have listservs with the artists so they have kept apprised of this legislation every step of the way. When we've had their contact information, they've been coming to the Capitol, giving us great feedback at this. Also, the other input into it, and I'll make it real short after this, Mr. Chair, is that over this interim when this bill was stalled at the end of last year, is the Health Department did a study over the summer and did some wonderful work. I'm looking for where they are here. Kyle Rennell in the audience here did some wonderful work looking into this area and doing field work as part of that. We learned a great deal from that. Also, the Board of Health also did a study. So the results of both the work from those two reports and then the further input from the body artists, I think we've come together with a very quality piece of legislation, and I've read pieces from other states that are in law, and I think we have a better one after this process than many states I've looked at. So people seem to be on board with this. What it basically does is it, first of all, the definitions are in 1.13 through 1.25, and we've gone beyond just the traditional tattoo and piercing, because in this extensive field work, we've identified many other practices that go on in our state that also needed some health and safety regulation, and they have been included in this bill and haven't necessarily been included in such in other states. We also license both the establishment, primarily focusing on all the health and safety. One of the concerns I had about the bills in the past that was over-regulatory. This approach in this bill is to not be overkill, to do what is absolutely essential for health and safety. We did not do, don't make people remodel their shops and tear down their buildings and start fresh. We are doing what's essential for health and safety in this bill and tried to make it as simple as possible. And then we license the technicians. They're either going to be a piercing technician or a tattoo technician, or they can have a dual license as well. So much of the bill is focused on the health and safety standards, but another key element of the bill, and this comes primarily from the artists, it's not from the blood bank folks, is the artist community actually wanted further controls in terms of consent, who was eligible to be tattooed or have piercings. They very much wanted minors not to be allowed to have permanent procedures done, whether that was tattooing or more permanent forms of other types of body art. And so in this bill, we have a new standard for our state. It is the standard that is most common throughout the United States. Of the states that are regulated, a large preponderance, over 80%, have this standard, meaning that no longer under this legislation can minors, with or without consent, have tattoos or other permanent types of procedures. Regular types of piercings can still be obtained by minors with parental consent, and we've tightened up the parental consent. The parent or guardian has to be present, and they have to sign a document in front of the technician. So we have provided more safety in that regard in terms of who is allowed to, and also traditional safeties like the person can't be intoxicated at the time and those kinds of things, and has to be in full control of their faculties at the time. So that information is also in this bill. From the fiscal standpoint, it's a usual type of licensing bill. The intent is eventually to have all the fees cover the licensing of these individuals. That's outlined in the both in the fiscal note that was handed out, but also in the amendment has the fiscal information in terms of the amount of the fees, usually $100 type fee for the primary annual licensing of the individual practitioners, a $1,000 establishment fee, etc. So the fiscal note, there is some upfront costs that funnies are taken from, I think, usually a special fund, special revenue fund, to fund it in the beginning, and then is paid back eventually once the fees start flowing in. So you'll see in the fiscal note that kind of structure, which is typical of our licensing initiatives.
Okay. Any questions? Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify?
Yes, sir.
Representative Dean has a question.
Oh. Mr. Chair, did we do the amendment?
Oh.
The A5?
We actually have not even moved the bill, so Representative Bunn.
Thank you so much. Mr. Chair, let me pull it right out. I move the bill and also the A5 amendment.
Okay, the bill has been moved, and she has now moved the A5 amendment. Do you want to describe that?
The amendment is just doing some further technical tweaking of the bill. We keep learning more as we go along in terms of some of the issues required in the field. Changes some of the issues in terms of how they'll do the initial licensing and the inspection and getting provisional licenses before they there's a provisional license that will take them a period of time initially to inspect every operation in the state. So they'll be issued a provisional license, and it tells the conditions under which that provisional license will stay in effect until the inspection has occurred. Also, other than that, couple of the health and safety issues we've altered a little bit. We decided technicians didn't need to have CPR, for example, those kinds of things. Other than that, most of this amendment is focused on adding the actual fee amounts, because we had gotten those back from the health department, which you see in 2.12 and down. So the $100 technician fees and the $1,000 establishment fees, etc.
Okay. Representative Vaughn moves the A5 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So So we now have the bill before us as amended. And Representative Bunn renews her motion that House File 677.
Oh, there's a question.
And we have a question.
Mr. Chairman. I've moved. I'm sorry. That's confusing. I just have a question. Since we had an anesthesia question from before, I'm looking at this bill and I'm saying there has to be some anesthesia involved here.
Representative Bunn.
Mr. Chair, and I wish I could find the line quickly. Maybe my health department would know what line's on, but it's these folks are not in the medical business, and in fact, that is explicitly not allowed in these kinds of practices, anesthesia. Oh. They can't inject anything, and they can't administer any medications to people. There's some exceptions, I think, in the cosmetology area, particularly in tattooing sensitive areas around eyes, things like that. There is some over-the-counter type topical anesthetics that are used in some practices, but mostly in the cosmetic tattooing area, not in the mainstream tattooing area.
A little warning.
Well, Mr. Chairman, definitely not my field of practice as a nurse, but I would say that I know. We're as nurses here, just really, just squeamish.
Four nurses in a row here.
Now, Mr. Hey. Chair, if the help, did I say that correctly? Okay, thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not a nurse, but you know, subdivision 34, tongue bifurcation.
Yep.
No anesthesia. Wow.
Well, and I must say, Mr. Chair, since Representative Lee Limo, this is one of the kinds of practices that were, you know, addressed or brought to our attention, as many others that are listed in there as well. These are some of the kinds of practices we're saying that you need to be an adult to have it done. But also, it's some of the kinds of practices that, you know, really aren't even addressed in other states. All these areas have been completely unregulated up to now in our state. They are in most states. And, in fact, I don't know of any of the other state legislation we looked at that are addressing any of these other practices. So it might be someplace down the road we might have to look at further in various ways. But for now, at least we're ensuring that everyone's using proper sterilization and dealing with bloodborne pathogens in an appropriate manner.
Okay, any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Bunn renews her motion that House File 677 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. All those as amended.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one last comment. We've been doing most of the work on the House side this session, and the Senate has this week adopted all this identical language, so we're on track to hopefully have a successful conclusion to this adventure. Okay?
Okay. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? So House File 677 is recommended to pass as amended and sent to the Finance Committee. Next, we're going to have Representative Thiessen. He's kind of in a rush, but I think all of his bills are, the intent is to lay them over for possible inclusion. And Representative Thiessen, do you want to start with 3250?
Let's start with 3066, if we
could. Okay, 3066. Oh, 3066. Okay. So, why don't you move the...
So I move House File 3066 be considered and laid over for the possible inclusion. And I'd like to move the A6 amendment, which is a... Is it that right? No, the A7 amendment. Excuse me, first, Mr. Chair.
So, Representative Thiessen has moved the A7 amendment. Do you want to describe that briefly?
Yeah, what the amendment does, it brings down the fiscal note to about $40,000, what they're telling me right now. What this bill is about is to get some uniformity in how health plans and county-based purchasing report their administrative expenses. It's based on a Department of Health report that we got last year in 2009.
There were two pieces to it in the bill previously. One was to do that, to come up with these uniform reporting periods, and a second piece, which was to have the department determine how to assess the reasonableness of administrative expenses. I think the reasonableness of those expenses is in our eyes instead of the Department of Health's eyes. And so we're just going to get the uniform reporting to us, and then we can make an assessment of what we think is reasonable or not. So it's taking out that piece that would have them come up with some kind of an assessment of reasonableness. And that's what this amendment does.
Okay. Any discussion of the amendment? So all those in favor of the A7 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the amendment is adopted.
And there... So what the bill is, essentially, on the finance side, what we would be doing with the money, there's a little bit of staffing involved. I mean, I don't think we have a fiscal note exactly yet, but a little bit of staffing involved, or maybe it's coming. And then they would hire an actuary from outside the plans and outside the department to actually provide some guidance and bring the plans and county-based purchasers together about how we would best report this investment income and administrative expenses. So that's where the money comes from. And I think it would be a very useful project. We've had a lot of discussion, obviously, in recent years about what's going on in the plans. And this is only related to our public programs. And I think just having a standard apples-to-apples comparison would help us quite a bit. And that's the gist of it. I do have the A6 amendment, which I'd like to move as well, Mr. Chair.
So Representative Thiessen moves the A6 amendment.
And the A6 amendment... Is another amendment that I'd just like to put on. I'm imagining there's going to be a cost, and so we'll have to address that when the time comes. I don't think it'll be significant, but what it does is basically there are probably, well, I think over 100 different reports that the plans and county-based purchasing have to give to the state. And what this would do is say, as part of this process of coming up with uniform reporting requirements, the commissioner should also identify which of these plans, and I'm ringing here, I'm sorry, which of these plans are duplicative, which of these plans we don't need anymore, and try to consolidate some of the reporting requirements so that we actually don't get overwhelmed with data and we get the data we need. And that's what this amendment does. And it's come to us from Prime West. They're the ones that are interested in doing this.
Okay. Any discussion of the A7 or A6 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? None, so the A6 amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Abler. Representative Abler.
Just to the whole bill and a comment, I think these are a really good direction to go. It seems to me on the actuary part, if you get broke toward the end and there's not even 40,000 laying around, that the plans have actuaries that they could bring along to the meeting, and just if you get tight for money. And since this would help them too, it seems, and so as they get together, just
and,
thought.
And Mr. Chair, and they are interested in that. I do think there would be a benefit to having someone outside the plans kind of at least provide some guidance, but I appreciate the thought.
Any other questions? Don't see any, so House File 3066 will be laid over for possible inclusion as amended in the omnibus bill.
Thank you. Can I move 3742 next?
And Representative Thiessen moves 3742.
For possible inclusion, this bill is a next step maybe in thinking about how we can help the general assistance medical care population and kind of bring some additional reform to that area. And it does just a couple of things. It provides grants to community health centers to expand, either develop new facilities, more likely expand existing facilities. These would be one-time grants, in particular in areas where, and it's the concept is they'd be one-stop shops for people that low-income people that need care, especially in those places where the COOs under the current bill would not have coverage, or where they do have coverage, but there's a distance that someone would have to travel. And so you can see what we're, and so if you look on the back page, basically appropriating $25 million to long-term homeless services, supportive services. This is something we've been talking about a long time. Many of you might remember Jennifer Ho came in last year and did a presentation on how much money we, they've actually run the numbers and if we can get people into stable housing. And I really think that this is the answer on the GAMC population. Get people into stable housing, we can change their lives and also radically change their health care costs. So that's moving in that direction.
And Jennifer Hull got asked to move to Washington.
She's with the she's with the administration now. $5 million for grants to homeless shelters to do street outreach and kind of connect people up. I mean, this is obviously the homeless population particularly is a challenging population. These folks have been really, really successful in reaching out to people, you know, that are homeless, that live outside, that you know, do those kind of things. And so this, I think, is our best and most will be our most successful access into that population. $12 million to provide grants that I talked about, the grants to develop some additional community health center capacity. $5 million to FQHCs, the $3 million to community clinics. Those are kind of bringing our funding back up to levels that we had previously before we made some cuts in recent years. $4 million for transitional housing. That comes back to the housing issues. And then we're dealing with some emergency and community action grants to. All of these are kind of restoring funding that we've cut over recent years that has affected this population. The $80 million figure came up because that is the difference between what the governor had in his transitional Minnesota care program, the money we were going to appropriate for transitional, for his, what is it called? Not transitional Minnesota. What?
Auto-enrollment.
Auto-enrollment proposal. The bill we ended up with was about $80 million less than the governor's proposal. So this is taking that money and trying to invest it in ways that I think will actually serve this population effectively. And so that is what the bill is.
Okay, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Thiessen, I want to absolutely applaud you for bringing this bill forward. Not only is it the right thing to do, and I think that the amount that you are using, this, the difference between the two bills is the right way, but we also know that all of the things that you are looking to appropriate are proven with this particular population. And so I know that we had talked about Jennifer Hull and the Hearth Connection and her coming to us last year showing how this worked. I personally know how it works because I worked for Jennifer Hull before I got to the legislature. And so I am, just with full disclosure, very, very familiar and have done work all over the state in 27 counties and spent a lot of my time in Representative Liebling and of district and others. This is the way to go. We talk about upstream and working with populations and the model of CARE accredited or associate care organizations or CCOs or ACOs. This gets us really upstream. There is a piece in this that I don't think that you can see in the bill, which is the relationship that is built, that is developed between the folks that work with people who are in this particular population, and how they start to trust themselves again, and thus they start to move forward and make decisions for themselves, which helps them to get better and keeps them out of all of the high cost services that we are trying to get out of paying. So once again, I wanted to, if it was appropriate, I'd give you a standing ovation. I think this is a fantastic bill and notion.
It's kind of interesting because it's different, but if we go back to the Alzheimer's thing, there's a lot more to improving someone's health than having a diagnosis by a physician and a prescription. And some of these outside things are as important as the medical care that they get for their health.
And I would say, Mr. Chair, that some of this early money went to help build the new San Marco, which I know that you're very fond of in Duluth.
Oh, no.
Trying to avoid being a client there.
Well, one other piece I should mention, that last piece that I skipped, the $20 million, that just adds $20 million more to the uncompensated care pool. On the assumption that some of the CCOs won't be, won't actually develop necessarily, and so it just, that's where the last $20 million comes from.
Okay, any questions on this one? Obviously, there's a financial impact, and
yeah,
we'll be
yes.
arguing about this later. I don't see any questions, so. House File 3742 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And what's your next one?
It is House File 3250.
Okay, Representative Thiessen moves that House File 3250 be laid over eventually for possible inclusion.
And Mr. Chair, there's an amendment, the A3 amendment, which changes how the funding is going. It actually reduces the amount of money that we're going to need because we're going to use, we're going to, in the bill as it's written, we're just using community, the kind of same grants that the Alzheimer's Project applied for and got. We were going to take some of that money. The way that they're structured this now, we're just going to take, we're going to reappropriate some of that money, put it in a different fund that can actually get federal match, and so we only need half as much money, essentially, to do this project. What the money is spent for is an actuarial study to prove that we can fund this, and these folks know much more about this bill than I do. I'm going to let them speak, and then if it's okay, if I just let them carry on from here, if it's okay.
That's
with
fine.
The chair. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Interesting proposition we have now, isn't it? Mr. Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers of Minnesota, and here representing the Long-Term Care Imperative. The PACE bill that's before you, the imperative is pleased to support. PACE is best described as a healthcare home for long-term care. This federal program offers a unique opportunity for Minnesota's providers of older adult services to put into practice the reform measures many legislators have been seeking, that is, cost-effective, community-based supports. Currently, there are 31 other states who have PACE. Minnesota, we have two provider organizations that are ready and willing to begin PACE sites. The imperative has long supported bringing PACE to Minnesota. It's been in statute for 5 years, but has yet to be implemented due to an inability to find acceptable funding sources. And with that, I will turn it over to Jen to talk more about the funding sources.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Jen McNerney with Aging Services of Minnesota, also the Long-Term Care Imperative.
And welcome back.
Thrilled to be, excuse me?
You're welcome back.
Thank you. It's my yearly appearance. as Mr. Pearson said, this is the culmination of a 5-year effort to implement PACE in Minnesota. It was put on the books 5 years ago, and at the time, providers were given or thought that they had the opportunity to contribute to the costs of an actuarial study that would determine how PACE would be implemented in Minnesota. However, the state attorney general decided that would be a conflict of interest for providers who were interested in participating in the program to also fund the actuarial study. And ever since then, we've been working with our provider members to try and find another funding source, including going to foundations and other philanthropical organizations who have told us that, in fact, this is better done at the government. And so here we are. We've decided on the CSSD grant pool as a funding source. It is a temporary funding source for FY 11 and 12. And for FY13, in the meantime, we would work with stakeholders in DHS to come up with an ongoing self-funding funding source so that we do not have to come back again. That, in a nutshell, is our testimony on PACE. And we'll be happy to take any questions.
Questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to either of the testifiers, as you have contemplated working with DHS on a self-funding mechanism, do you have ideas about that, or is that a conversation yet to be had?
We have had, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we've had some conversations. They have run the gamut from some licensing fees or even some kind of capturing some of the payment from MA. It's an integrated funding stream, but we have not decided on anything yet.
Any other questions? Abler.
Hi.
Abler.
Thanks. Well, so you need ongoing actuarial work? It's not just a 2-year startup to figure it out and then it runs somehow?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I don't believe it's ongoing. I believe it's to determine where it will work and if it will work in particular because it's by community. And I don't know if the actuarial study is actually ongoing or not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, my understanding is that the actuarial study is just the one-time startup, and then the ongoing will just be the administration of the program. And so the ongoing funding needs are, the department is working on what that amount would be. And then as Ms. McNerney said, there are various funding sources out there from licensing fees or taking some of the payment back.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Avery. I'm just kind of rusty on this whole program, and so I'm not looking for the very long answer, but is if this is sort of a wraparound package, would it be designed to save money and have a better outcome, or cost the same money with a better outcome, or cost more for a better outcome?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I believe the design of those who are going into it is to provide a better outcome at a lesser cost because of the efficiencies in providing kind of the health care home for long-term care.
And just so that's
Representative Abler.
I thought you'd say that. So why would you need any money in the future at all if it's going to save money? Wouldn't this program up and running have a fiscal savings at some point then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, the goal is to be self-funding. So hopefully after these 2 years, we wouldn't have to come back and worry about it. But
all right.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
Just to come back then.
That's something else.
I can hear Representative Thiessen renewing his motion that House File 3250 be laid over for possible inclusion of the omnibus bill. And
did we do the amendment?
Did we do the amendment?
No.
Yeah, we did.
Yep.
As amended.
So thank you very much. And next we'll go to Representative Liebling, House File 1640.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1640, and then I have a DE2 amendment that I would like to move.
So Representative Liebling moves House File 1640 and then moves that it be amended with the DE2 amendment.
And then,
Mr. Chair,
I do have a couple of really minor little fixes to the DE2 amendment, if we could, before we... that I'd like to incorporate before we adopt that. And on one of them is on line 1.4, there's the word recommendations, which I would like to just strike that word.
Yeah.
Well, why don't you wait till everybody gets a copy of the amendment. Okay, why don't you proceed?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. On line 1.4, just strike the word recommendations. And then on line 3.9, just strike the word recommended.
Okay, Representative Liebling is amending her amendment to, on line 1.4, strike the word recommendations, and on line 3.9, strike the word recommended. That would get her an amendment in the way she wants it, so why don't we just incorporate those, and Representative Liebling, go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Should we adopt the DE2 then as with those?
Yes. Okay. All those in favor of the DE2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, members, this bill, you may recall, was heard by the Policy Committee, and I know not everybody's on that committee, but many of you are, so I don't want to rehash the entire thing. I'm not going to say a lot. This is a program for independent prescriber education. In other words, we know that pharmaceutical companies do a lot of what we call drug detailing, where they give education or really marketing to prescribers about their products by going and visiting them personally. This is a program to do the same kind of thing, but with independent evidence-based information, to which would be voluntary for providers to participate in, but it would make available to them the same kind of at-your-door availability of independent prescribing information. And I'm going to stop talking and allow my testifiers to take over there and hopefully move through this fairly quickly, because I know the hour is getting late.
Sure. Representative Huntley, members of the committee, my name is Marilyn Speedy. I'm dean of the College of Pharmacy at the University of Minnesota. I'm speaking in favor of this bill 1640. Academic detailing is a method of outreach education for prescribers, physicians, and other health professionals who prescribe drugs that brings accurate, up-to-date synthesis of drug information, but also other methods of their other therapies to them in a face-to-face manner. There are many studies that show that the face-to-face method is actually the most effective of way of getting the information to prescribers where they need it. We know that there are satisfaction studies among prescribers that really appreciate the nurses or pharmacists that do the visits, coming and talking to them directly and being able to discuss various therapies. The information is synthesized from primary research. It is done in other states, and so some of that work can be taken from work of other investigators, but also we are capable of doing that within the University of Minnesota to integrate the information and present it, develop educational materials, train the educators, and present that to physicians and other prescribers. This is not new. It's been done for a long time in Australia and Canada is where it started. The effectiveness was well demonstrated, but a number of states as well, Pennsylvania being the original one within the United States, Maine, Massachusetts, Vermont, and several others have academic detailing programs that are have been shown to be effective in improving the quality of prescribing by physicians. And that really is the goal, to target the diseases or the patients or the prescribers where the need is greatest, where the misuse is most observed, and to then to tailor the programs to these people. It would be voluntary on the part of physicians and prescribers. No one's going to be forced to visit with the detailers, but the states where this has been done, the physician satisfaction is very high, and they do like having this service. The goal, as I mentioned, is really just to improve prescribing, to get high quality prescribing and therapies that will reduce costs for the state programs, but really the major goal is to improve quality. Thank you.
Representative Huntley, Chairman Huntley, I'm Peter Wyckoff. I'm staff of the Minnesota Prescription Coalition. As Dean Speedy indicated, this legislation is designed to provide a service to practitioners, the prescribers, to provide unbiased information in a timely, fashionable way It's been shown that this information, doctors like it on a survey, which is incurred, which is in part of the packet of materials that you have seen. On a 5-point scale, doctors are really extraordinarily supportive of this. This is done in December of this past year. On a 4.5 basis, physicians really appreciate it. They see it as effective. 26 studies have shown it to be effective and cost-effective. As Dean Speedy indicated, the costs on the whole have been shown where states have invested in these programs directly to pay for themselves at the very least. Harvard studied indicate an actual savings and better outcomes as much as 2-to-1. And the most mature program in actually the world is probably coming out of Australia, where for every dollar that the Australian government has done in a voluntary academic detailing program for which 75% of the physicians voluntarily participate, they have saved $5. And most importantly, they have improved therapeutic outcomes. They have improved lives. They improved the safety of the prescriptions developed. We are not pioneering in this program. As the packet of materials that you have there points out, there are now 9 other states in various degrees of establishing a program. Those are described in the chart that you have in the packet of material. And then there's a separate 2-page program which talks more specifically about the most developed program in this country, which comes out of Pennsylvania in their academic dealing program in an effort. The major changes between this legislation and the amendment and the bill you had before you comes down actually relatively, most of them relatively minor. We've really tried to hear some of the comments made by the policy committee. There was concern about fraud and abuse language being directed at this program, and it's not the intent of this program, so that has been deleted. There are also various efforts to try to make sure that we can work with the Department of Human Service to limit the scope of the program to the areas that will be most effective in improving outcomes and reducing costs. The final section of changing is really in Subdivision 6, where we have worked with the Department of Human Services to come up with a formulation that would seem to be operable for them. They're still in the process of doing this fiscal note, but that should be ready in the next few days. And so I think we also worked with the Board of Pharmacy in working through that as well.
Well, I'm a person that believes that corporations don't pay any taxes. They just charge higher prices to everybody else. So if we put in a fee, won't that raise the price of the drugs that the
state
buys?
You're talking about a fee here, which is, and you may hear it differently from the industry, which is incidental. We're talking about a 0.5% fee of the buy, not the sales in Minnesota or anywhere else, by the Department of Human Services. And altogether, through all 500 companies that might be affected of this, raising a total of about $1.4 million to put it comparable to other states in those areas. So, I mean, this is far less than the cost of one commercial detailer who's paid $90,000 in themselves on average. And I would submit that it's in the best interest of the pharmaceutical industry, generic manufacturers and stuff, to get good clinical, unbiased information into the hands of doctors in a way that provides this in a convenient and an effective way. And this is, again, we would be joining a number of other states that have really done the pioneering work in this and have shown this to be appreciated by the medical community, terribly cost-effective, and most importantly, improving clinical outcomes.
Representative Abler.
Oh. Is the department going to testify about
it? We have some other people as well.
Oh, okay. Well,
okay.
I'll wait. I just...
We have two people that have signed up to testify, Marjorie Powell and Judy Cook. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marjorie Powell. I'm the Senior Assistant General Counsel of Pharma, the trade association representing the women and the men, including many of those people here in Minnesota who are doing the research and the development to discover, do the clinical trials for, and bring to market new medicines. I'm very pleased to represent those people, but I'm urging the committee to reject this bill. Because this is a financial committee, let me focus on financial issues. You did hear about the funding. I'd like to make it very clear that when a state establishes a licensing fee, there are a series of court cases that make clear that a licensing fee can be used to cover the administrative costs of running a licensing program. When a fee is focused on First Amendment activities, there, such as speech, there are some additional concerns. The licensing fee language in this bill, as amended, is identical to the licensing fee that was in the academic detailing provision of a bill that passed, I think it's 3 years ago now, in Vermont. And that, among a dozen things that that bill did, it established an academic detailing program to be licensed by, to be funded by a fee imposed on pharmaceutical manufacturers. Several groups challenged that bill. Pharma challenged the provisions, not the licensing fee of that bill, but some other portions of that bill. The Attorney General's office had assured the committee that that licensing fee provision would be constitutional. But when the Attorney General's office actually had to defend the fee in litigation, they went back to the legislature and asked the legislature to amend that statute to take out the fee provisions. So the academic detailing program in Vermont has not actually gotten off the ground because they don't have a source of funding. You will see from one of your handouts that I've identified a couple of the cases as early as 1943, the U.S. Supreme Court said that if you are establishing a licensing fee, it can be used to cover the cost of policing the activities being licensed, not for some other program. In this case, the fee would be required of manufacturers, including manufacturers in this state, and it would be essentially used to tell physicians and other prescribers that they should not be using or prescribing the medicines that are paying for that fee. It seems, given the support for the life sciences industry within the state of Minnesota, that what you really wouldn't want to say, we're encouraging you to develop a new medicine, a new way of administering a medicine, and then turn around and have state employees telling physicians in the state that they shouldn't actually be using that medicine. So the fee may or may not be an appropriate source of funding. It's not one that I think the legislature should rely on. I'd also like to point out that this activity duplicates activity that is or should be going on in the state by the DUR Board, Drug Utilization Review Board, which is part of the one of the requirements for the federal state Medicaid program. The DUR Board is required to provide education on the appropriate use of medicines and appropriate treatments, and they are to be evaluating the effectiveness of that program to educate prescribers on the effectiveness of medications. In addition, all physicians within the state of Minnesota have a requirement to take continuing medical education courses. Those courses are offered by the University of Minnesota and by a variety of other educators within the state. If, in fact, the committee decides that physicians within the state need more information about how to prescribe, what kinds of treatments to prescribe, how to recommend behavioral changes before prescribing. The simple solution would be to impose a specific requirement that physicians take continuing medical education courses in how to make appropriate prescribing decisions. I'd also like to note that these kinds of programs are potentially costly to implement. The program that was developed in Pennsylvania is operated in a, it applies only to physicians who are prescribing for senior citizens with Medicare for whom the state is contributing to the cost of drugs while seniors are in the so-called donut hole where they have no coverage. It is a very small program. It costs about $1.5 million a year to operate. We have consistently asked for copies of any studies that show any cost savings from that program, and we have not seen any studies. It is actually operated by pharmacists from the from Harvard University, and I'm knowing, as I do, a number of people who are on the faculty at Harvard, I would anticipate that if there were any studies that would meet the requirements for publication in a peer-reviewed journal, that the Harvard researchers would have published those studies, but we have not been able to find any. So I would be fairly leery of believing that this is in fact going to save money, particularly when you consider that in Minnesota, and you have a chart that indicates the generic dispensing rate, in Minnesota approximately 80% of all scripts are filled with generic drugs. Patients get a brand name drug only when that is the only treatment that would be available or when they are not able to take a generic drug or the generic drug is not effective for them. The major thing that the academic detailing program in Pennsylvania has done is to encourage physicians to prescribe generic products. If you look at that chart, you'll see that there is not a great deal of room for saving by encouraging the dispensing of generic products in Minnesota, which has an automatic substitution law so that the patient will get a generic program. The South Carolina program is a pilot program in two or three counties that covers two disease areas, and it's cost about $1.9 million. The Massachusetts program is just getting started, and it is too soon to know whether there will be any saving. In addition, because FDA approves approximately 30 new medicines every year and approves several hundred additional uses for already approved medicines, any program would need to be updated potentially every year within any given disease category to account for new medicines that would be available, to account for new uses for existing medicines, and to account for studies that show that a particular medicine is or is not effective with any single group of patients. So to have the state actually implementing this kind of program would require continuous review and updating of information, the kinds of things that academic medical people are doing at the University of Minnesota and at other teaching hospitals in the state, and that they are incorporating already within the continuing medical education programs that they're offering that focus on disease areas or specific categories of physician services. So we urge that this bill be not passed this year. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Questions? Don't sing it right now, so Ms. Cook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Judy Cook with Cook Hill Girard Associates. I'm here today on behalf of Mylan, a leading generic drug manufacturer. I'm testifying in opposition to House File 1640, in particular to the fee that is assessed on generic drug manufacturers. This fee at 0.5% of sales to public programs is not minimal, as was suggested earlier. Any fee increase to generics is of concern because of the very competitive marketplace in which generics operate. As was stated earlier, utilization of generics in Minnesota is approximately 80%, particularly in the public programs. So there really isn't much room for increased use of generics. Except to the extent that new generics will enter the marketplace, and we don't seem to be having any difficulty with those gaining utilization once they come on the market. And we certainly don't think that there's that much room for an increase as a result of an academic detailing program, certainly not enough to make up for the additional fee on generics. And I'm not the best person to talk about this, but I would like to remind you that since this is focused at public programs, we do have a preferred drug list. My recollection is that they do make evidence-based decisions on what drugs to cover. But it's been a while since I've looked at that. But generics are approximately 25% of the cost in public programs, so we are already providing significant savings to the state. We already pay a rebate on our drugs in medical assistance and GAMC. And again, because we're sold in such a competitive marketplace, we have very small margins. There are some drugs that could be break-even or even a loss after the rebate. And generic companies don't do detailing because the pricing structure is so competitive, and we already have such high utilization. So I'd like to let you know we were neutral on this legislation until the fee was added. We suggest that an effective detailing program should pay for itself or generate savings. You don't need a multi-million dollar fee. We do support the education of prescribers and consumers about cost-effective prescription drug options, but we don't think that this funding mechanism is appropriate and would oppose any increase in fees on generic manufacturers. Thank you. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for the last two testifiers? Don't say anything, so thank you for your testimony, and so we're...
Mr. Chair, could the department come down?
What
if they're here?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Sarah Drake. I'm from the Department of Human Services.
Well, could you just give me a couple random thoughts about what you think about this, and I have a couple specific questions. You must have a reaction to what you've heard in the bill, and is there a department position on this? Do you like it? Are you nervous?
We don't have a position, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, we're neutral at this time. We've been working with Representative Liebling to try to determine more what the intent of the bill is and what the scope of the program would be. This was just moved over to our agency last week, and we got the request for the fiscal note, I think, 2 days ago. So we're trying to work through the implications to our department. We have a lot of questions about how the fee structure would be enforced and what the scope of the program would be in terms of what prescribers would be targeted, how often the visits would be, if they would be group visits or individual visits, if it would be where we would target prescribers and go visit them, or if they would request the detailers to come, things like that. So that's what we're trying to work through. Representative Liebling has been helpful, and we're going to continue to meet with her to try to understand what the intent is so we can put the fiscal note together correctly.
And Mr. Chair. Well, thanks. I have a couple of questions for you then. Thank you for that. Welcome to the project. Can you have a couple questions? How much money do you think this would raise? Do you have an estimate about that? Is it
Mr.
a million?
Chair, Representative Abler, if we can assume that we would be able to get all the fees from the manufacturers, I spoke to my counterpart in Vermont this morning, and they just started collecting fees this year. They do it annually rather than quarterly. That's in this bill, and they still haven't gotten all of them because not all the manufacturers have paid, and there's been a lot of mailings and following up and that kind of thing. But if we can assume that we could get the whole 0.5%, I think it would be about $1.25 million.
Okay. And Mr. Chair?
Representative Abler.
What I like about this project, I'm developing some major concerns about parts of it. But what I like about the idea is going after some of the people who seem to be the heavier prescribers than others. And I'm, if you've heard my comments on other projects, there's a bell curve of behaviors. And does the department do anything? I mean, and you spend a lot of money on pharmaceuticals, and there's a concern about over-prescribing, and I suppose in some cases under-prescribing. But does the department do anything about, you know, the top 5 or 10% of the people who really give way more drugs than some of their comrades?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, are you referring to physicians?
Prescribers. Well, any kind of prescriber. Do you do anything at all to look at their use and tell them they're high and choosing a lot of this stuff? That's curious to us, why you're using so much.
Our drug utilization board, that's part of the work that they do. We don't look at particular, you're a high prescriber overall, because a lot of times it depends on what kind of meds they're prescribing or what patient population that they're seeing. Someone might be the highest prescriber in our population, but it's because they just, all they see is our population. But our DUR board does look at prescribing patterns and utilization patterns, and they meet quarterly, and they send educational mailings to prescribers on different topics. So recently there was one that went out on antipsychotics for individuals that were on more than one antipsychotic. We've also done one where on drugs that were prescribed for individuals that didn't have an indication, an FDA-approved indication for that medication. And so in those cases, the mailings are sent to the prescribers along with the patient profile information and some contact information for us if the prescriber wants to call and ask questions or provide us information, because it's kinda, a lot of times a two-way learning street. So we do that kind of activity where we look at practices that we're hearing about in the community that might be a problem. We have a contractor that works with us to help identify drug utilization criteria, and they run all of our claims through algorithms to determine outliers, and those are when we send the mailings.
Mr. Chair, and do you find that the people actually, the physicians or whoever your prescribers actually read this stuff and react to it, or is it just more mail that they get from you that they're too busy to look at?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, from what I hear from our DUR coordinator, they must read them, because she definitely gets calls after the mailings go out. Sometimes, you know, they say, I'm not treating this patient anymore, or we get a lot of calls just clarifying or providing additional information, so they must be reading them.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I wasn't part of the other committee that heard this presentation before, so this is the first time. But I do get concerned a bit when we have the FDA, who really does have oversight of the patenting of these products, and then we are kind of putting another layer of folks in the middle, it seems like, who are providing additional, or at least what they think is additional information. And I think that, you know, that's maybe fine in the beginning, but it has the implications of maybe going a little too far, and, you know, being the person who can say yes or no to any pharmaceutical products. I just get a little concerned about, again, the heavy-handedness of this, the potential of this program.
Mr.
Chair. And so that's just me at this, hearing this at this point in time. So outside of the financial pieces, I guess, and perhaps it's because I didn't hear it in the policy committee, but I can see certainly some advantages. I don't like the idea of the money either, because I do think there's a pretty slim margin. But anyway, and I do think they certainly use generics all the time. It's a question of whether, my question would be, you know, are there good information that they're giving about whether the generics are effective and providing the same kinds of benefits that the brand names are? So a lot of people are concerned about that. But you have, I'm sure, much more information. And I have a little disclaimer, too, because my brother was in Washington, D.C., is one of those folks that did the determining whether drugs got patented or not. He was a doctor who had to make some of those determinations, and I heard from him very often about the kind of work that went into making the determination about whether to put a pharmaceutical product on the market and the kind of research that goes into that. So
maybe I have some bias of my own, but anyway.
Mr. Chair, may I respond?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson, I think there's a misunderstanding about what the program is, what it does. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's education. It's not heavy-handed. It's offering education to people, prescribers who would be interested in having it. So there's no heavy-handedness involved. I don't see how there could be. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the testifiers here was talking about how the program would have to be updated every year because all these new medications and new uses are coming out. This isn't about the use or the whether any particular drug is a good drug. This is that prescribers have to decide in an individual case whether it's the right thing, how it interacts with other drugs. And right now, they, at least from the brand name drugs, they have detailers who go out and visit individually to talk about the benefits of that drug. Mm-hmm. These would be people who would be doing that to talk about how to use various drugs or which things might be effective in which situations. I also want to correct a misconception here that I think has been promoted a bit by the other testifiers, that this is primarily to promote generic drugs. It is not to promote generic drugs. It's to help providers use drugs most appropriately and help them keep up with information that is coming out very rapidly, as the testifier noted. I mean, that's a reason to do this kind of program, not a reason not to do it, because it's very difficult, I think, for providers to keep up. And even though they may have the best intentions, they are very busy. That's why this person-to-person kind of information has been shown to be very effective, and that's why pharmaceutical companies do it. Because it is effective. That's why they market that way, rather than just sending a flyer or, you know, I mean, they do a lot of different things, but, you know, that is seen as a very effective way to market drugs. So it's not intended to be heavy-handed at all. Also, when we talk about cost savings, I think a misconception that's kind of being floated here is that the cost savings is somehow is just to use cheaper drugs or use less of them. But a lot of the cost savings might be in doing appropriate prescribing, in using the right drug at the right time in the right amounts, and not using drugs that interact with each other. Because, and in fact, I have Caleb Schultz, who's here, who works with me and who's a physician, could talk about how that works, because sometimes when people are getting, especially as they get older, they're getting drugs in the wrong amounts, they're getting multiple drugs that could be interacting with each other, and that can prolong illness, it can create more disability, and could increase our costs in other ways. But more importantly, you get not as good of an outcome, you could be ill longer, and so on. So it's not just, this is not primarily an intention to tell physicians or other prescribers that they should use generics. That is not the point of the program. And I don't know if you want to hear from
you
Dr. Schultz.
You could keep it brief. Be happy to hear what you have to say.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. My name is Dr. Caleb Schultz. I work as an emergency physician in Minnesota and in Iowa. I'm also the health policy director for Representative Tina Liebling through the University of Minnesota School of Public Health Executive Master's in Public Health Program. It's a long introduction. But to speak to this as a physician, there are multiple ways that good quality care can improve the cost of care that we provide. So it's not just about the generics. It's not just about the brand names. It's about what's most effective, what's the safest, what's the most efficacious for the patients. Generally, when we're providing the highest quality care we can, based on non-biased information, the outcomes are better, and therefore the costs are lower. You know, that's the main take-home point from this type of education program. Non-biased information provided in a way that's most effective, that physicians or other prescribers can have a dialogue with the detailer to further their understanding of the most appropriate uses of these medications. There's no pushing me as a doctor to prescribe a certain drug. It's simply information that I can implement and utilize as it seems appropriate for my patients.
So Representative, I'm sorry.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson, I just wanted to say your brother, I don't think this would cause him to disapprove because it really wouldn't conflict at all with anything that the FDA is doing. It would have nothing to do with whether the drugs are good drugs and usable drugs.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one follow-up question. Rather than the wholesale drug distributors are they paying for this or are the doctors paying for it? It seems like it's a subscription service that the doctors would want to have, right? Or am I, this is new, I'm just reading this now as the fee.
No? Mr. Chair, Representative, the fee is on manufacturers of pharmaceuticals. It is not applied to a prescriber. The prescriber can choose to have access to the education service. There's also a provision where health systems and other groups may potentially choose to purchase some sort of access to the academic detailing program for a larger group of prescribers. But at the way the bill is arranged, the fee would be on pharmaceutical manufacturers. To clarify what a previous testifier said, this isn't a licensing fee. This is separate from a licensing fee. It's not a licensing fee. The licensing fee that is already in place was an initial consideration, but that is no longer the case. This is simply on a percentage of fee on what is bought by DHS for public medical programs.
Just to further clarify that, if I may also, the pharmaceutical representative also indicated this funding language literally is lifted from Vermont, quite literally, and we worked through Vermont. That legislation has actually been upheld in courts and is now being implemented, and I think DHS made a recommendation. It's only been in the last few months, so they're really at the very beginning of doing this, and so they are receiving funds from this, and the program is being implemented in Vermont as we speak.
I'm going to be labor.
We have three other people lined up here. Representative Bunn, Representative Kiffmeyer, and Representative Dean. Representative Bunn, you're first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up with the agency person. I'm sorry, I missed your name. To follow up Representative Abler's line of questioning, you indicated that you do have a contractor that does, with the Drug Utilization Board, that does, tracks utilization of various prescribers. But I concluded from what you said that the only thing that might happen to them, if they're an outlier in some way, is that they would get sent some information in the mail. So I want to ask again so that we're real clear, is there any penalty to them in any way from participation in our public programs or payments they receive for being an outlier other than, or is only the thing that happens is they receive some information in the mail?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, through our DU or our board, the only thing they would receive is some educational information in the mail. There's no penalty. It's not punitive. Our DU or board activities are strictly educational.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That sounded like a careful answer in that you said through our DU or board. So through any other mechanism of our public programs and the administration of this, is there any kind of taking into account this utilization data that affects them in any way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, I can't speak to that. I believe our SIRS unit, the surveillance unit, mm-hmm. They look at fraud and abuse mm-hmm. type issues, and sometimes they can identify fraudulent billing and that kind of mm-hmm. thing through utilization data. So I can't say that the utilization data sometimes isn't used for that purpose. But in terms of what our DUR board does, it's just educational.
Representative Bunn.
One last question then. Having been familiar with some of this on the dental side of things, oftentimes when this surveillance is done and the provider is confronted, or the prescriber in this case, confronted with their pattern being out of line with comparable groups, same demographics, same types of clients, et cetera, that quickly one sees it fall in line with the norms for that group. Do we know in this case whether, do you track whether or not the provision of this information in the mail actually leads to changes in behavior or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, yes, we get, at every board meeting, we review previous what we call interventions or mailings, and it tracks the change in the trend from what we were seeing before the mailing to what we saw after the mailing, and then it equates that to change in utilization as well as any kind of cost savings.
The Representative Bunn.
Thank you. One last question and then one comment after that, Ms. Chair. In terms of what the board does, and some other point in time, I'd like to learn a lot more about that, do the issues that Representative Liebling raised, which I think are real wonderful selling points of this proposal you have in terms of your summary, I think, was terrific in terms of what the real point of this legislation was, and it's very appealing in terms of we know we have a lot of anecdotal information about drug interactions, about excessive prescription, people in nursing homes on 25, 26 medications, all that kind of stuff. And it seems like there's a lot to be gained both in terms of health and also in terms of appropriate prescribing by more sophisticated education going on. Is part of what the board does is not just to, that's outside this utilization statistic stuff, to look at multiple prescribing, particularly in certain settings like nursing homes and things like that, to try to educate people further on the appropriateness of the numbers of drugs and their interactions, or how detailed you get into that quality issue in terms of service around this prescribing area?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, the mailings that we do look at a variety of topics. We have done a number of them on polypharmacy. We haven't done anything specifically for nursing homes because of the Medicare Part D benefit that went into effect. A lot of the dually eligibles in nursing homes, we don't see most of their drug expenditures anymore. But we have done mailings, like I said, on individuals that are on multiple antipsychotics. We've looked at individuals on diabetes drugs, oral diabetes drugs that maybe aren't being compliant and aren't taking their medication frequently. We let the doctors know that it appears that the patients are non-compliant with their diabetes medications. So to answer your question, the role of the DUR board, it looks at utilization and trends and really looks for opportunities to improve clinical outcomes and the clinical use of drugs.
Thank you. Okay, let's see. Next is Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I like the concept of what you're trying to do here, Representative Liebling, in regards to information. The concern I have, though, is with the language of the bill. And one of the points is the fee. And generally, when a fee is charged, there's something in return to the entity paying the fee. And this is not that kind of circumstance, is what I can see here. But probably my greatest concern is that when it comes to drug information, the FDA regulates even oral statements. And so when you have folks going out and personally interacting with the prescribers and they're giving that information, that distinction between them and the FDA and the very strict oral underlining, highlighting, I mean, they are very, very tightly regulated to that. And this looks to me more like something that in writing, the kind of a sense of a subscription. I think physicians are probably interested in getting some of that. So those are just my concerns. I think you've addressed some of this or spoken to it before, and I've listened to that, but I really am not satisfied at this time that those have been addressed sufficiently to have support for this bill in this current language.
Okay, Representative.
Maybe you can address some of this if you wish. I mean, I'm not saying you have other comments, but.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer, I'm not exactly sure that I understood the concern about the fee, but I wasn't sure if I understood your other concern that you were expressing. Could you maybe, I don't know how much we want to go into it, but can you The sure. other concern about the concern about what the FDA regulating what people are allowed to say, I didn't quite understand why that was a concern with this program.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, when you have the one track where you have the detailing, the information given out about the drugs, it's very, very prescriptive. Or even oral, even to the point of when they come out and do their personal visits with the prescribers, even their oral comments, emphasis, things like that. And so here I'm looking at this, and there's going to be information on these drugs being given out, especially in a comparative kind of a basis. And so then I have a real concern about they may mean well, but may make oral statements or other methods of communication, and I just have a concern about that getting crosswise with, because you're still giving out drug information, and it's being done by people who are not in the chain of the FDA. So I just have a concern about that.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, a couple of points. Number one, the FDA has the regulations that they do on prescription data, prescription detailing from pharmaceutical companies, because it is not educational in its main purpose, it is marketing in its purpose. So there is the regulation on a marketing profit component of those visits. The academic detailing program is simply that, academic. It's education. The FDA does not need to be involved in, as I understand it, the educational components. Just as I, as a physician, if I go to a national conference and speak about my experience using a medication or a research project that I did, I don't have to go through the FDA to determine what I emphasize, what I bold or underline in my presentation. It's an educational focus, not a marketing focus, which makes the FDA requirements very different.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I understand that, but I don't see the connection here in regards to you speaking as a person individually. Clearly, the disclaimer is this is your personal experience, and so I don't see that as a connection. But I think when I hear you talk about non-biased dialogue, and then you're talking about specific drugs in a comparative way, I just have a concern about that. It's one thing when you have things written, because everybody can see what's written. And you can have that, and you can screen it, and you can put it out. But as soon as you start introducing oral and dialogue and some of those kinds of things, that's where my level of concern is.
Dean Speedy.
Thank you, Chair Huntley. Representative Kiffmeyer, if I may address that, part of the reason you have health professionals doing the detailing, it's nurses and pharmacists, is that in fact what you have is interprofessional exchange of information. That happens all the time in all kinds of settings, orally and otherwise. I think exchange of information, that happens all the time in all kinds of settings, orally and otherwise. I think what you're talking about is comparative effectiveness between drugs. That's not regulated at all by the FDA. What they say about individual drugs, they could not encourage, for instance, off-label use. But talking about drugs within FDA approved uses and side effects and so on, certainly you have lots of oral exchange between professionals all the time. Now, this information in academic detailing is actually pulling from the literature to do comparative, various studies to develop information about what comparative effectiveness is for individual prescribers. But from my understanding of other programs, in fact, part of what the physicians enjoy is the interchange, the professional interchange between health professionals. So it's not marketing, and it is education. But it's education in a normal professional exchange.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have forgotten, maybe I'm just tired, but what is the trajectory of this bill? Is this on its own or is this laid over?
It's going to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Liebling, do you know how many other states, I don't really know very much at all about the Drug Utilization Review Board. It sounds to me like kind of an interesting thing that we do that I really didn't know very much about it. Can you tell me how many other states do this and what kinds of, is it electronic information? How is this shared with the physicians and the prescribers?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative
Liebling,
I'm not sure if you're asking about how many other states do academic detailing or how many other have a drug utilization review board. And it, depending on which it is, I guess it depends, will determine who answers the question here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Liebling, I'm referring to the Drug Utilization Review Board.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, all states have a DUR board. It's mandated in the federal Medicaid regulations under Title 19.
Thank you.
And Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, just a couple of questions for Representative Liebling, and I apologize. I'm not on the policy committee, and I'll try to limit it to the fiscal portions of the bill. I see two provisions for a fee. One on page 2.30, the commissioner shall consider the establishment of a fee. And then also on page 3.10, fee assessed, and that goes into the 0.5% fee that was discussed earlier. Are those two things the same thing, or are those two different fees or taxes or however it's going to be looked at?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean. No, it's one fee.
Okay, so they're referring to the same thing.
Yes.
And Mr. Chair and
Representative
Liebling, I've got several concerns with this, most of which have to do with why we would be asking the providers to do even more than we already are. But the primary concern is just how this is going to be brought out. The prescribers currently do get lots and lots of information from journals, technical manuals, and from pharmaceutical representatives. And in the documentation that was put out, it says 60% to 70% of pharmaceutical information doctors receive from the pharmaceutical industry, such information is not objective and does not provide the best independent clinical evidence. And I guess that most professionals deal with product manufacturers, and we deal with lobbyists here that we have professional relationships with, and we rely on them to give us accurate information, and to the extent that they're professional and good at what they do, they will give us both sides, and they come from a specific viewpoint, but if they're good at what they do, they give us accurate information, and if they don't, we don't deal with them anymore. And I think physicians and prescribers rely upon information, both independent, academic, and professional, in the same way. And I have concern that we're asking them to do even more. It says the commissioner, and from the DUR board, we say the commissioner may further limit the outreach and education of to those prescribers for whom improvements in clinical prescribing outcomes and safety would lead to the greatest benefit of the state. That's kind of frightening that we would kind of have these prescriber police that would be, aimed at certain folks to be sent out. And they're probably seeing 25, 30 patients a day, and they're probably trying to read their journals, and they maybe see a detailed person here or there, and they probably don't have time for lunch. And I don't know that they, I don't want to make them interact with anybody they don't have to interact with from the state. So I have some policy issues with this, but primarily for the fiscal impact and the fee on this that has been assessed, I'm not comfortable moving this forward. And Mr. Chair, I would ask that we would lay this on the table.
That's a non-debatable motion to lay it on the table. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
I think the ayes have it. Bill is laid on the table. Jim.
And Representative Huntley, let me apologize again for holding you to the very end. I think we need to work on our interpersonal relations here, and if you can behave a little better,
the real
next time we can take you earlier.
Sure.
Yeah. So I think we'll do 35-44 first. Is that right?
That's
you have a witness
correct.
For that?
And let's see.
Your chair's really hot.
I have an amendment to that provided me by the department to do what we thought we were doing, and that would be on line. I'll move House File 3544 be recommended pass and then eventually laid over for possible inclusion. The amendment is on line 113. After the waivers, comma, insert home care services covered under section 256B.0651, comma, subdivision 2, comma.
Representative Huntley is moving on line 1.13 to after the word waivers before the comma?
After
the comma. Home care services covered under 256.0651 subdivision 2.
And
256.0651 comma subdivision 2. There's no comma.
The purpose of that is to exclude home care services. We did
staff
not
will be instructed.
We did not want to get into continuing care. This is an attempt to reduce payments to managed care for the public programs, medical assistance, general assistance, medical care, and Minnesota care, and take the same amount of money so there's no fiscal impact and increase reimbursements in the fee-for-service system for physicians and other professional services.
We have to see if people will be willing to vote for your amendment, first of all, Representative Huntley. So everybody understand the amendment on line 1.13? Any questions? Anybody want to testify for or against the amendment? Just kidding. After the word waivers, comma, insert home care services covered under 256.0651 subdivision. 256B.0651 subdivision 2. And there will be commas inserted wherever staff feels like it. Everybody understand that? Questions? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? You're in a good run there, Representative Huntley. So,
okay.
Welcome to the committee.
I have Mr. Jim Meffert Nelson to comment on the bill. And then there'll be people on the other side, obviously.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Jim Meffert, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Optometric Association, and I just briefly wanted to explain the genesis of this proposal. As you can see from the letter enclosed, and as I'm sure you've heard from many providers, there's a great frustration out there with the rates that are paid under the fee-for-service program, in particular for public programs. We hear it all the time, and we're hearing from our members the difficulty in maintaining the program. They want to stay in the program. They want to provide services to their community. The biggest frustration is that there isn't the ability to increase the rates on an annual basis. They feel like there isn't the recognition that there's an adjustment that's happening to recognize the increase in their costs. But there are other places where that happens, with the PMAP rates, with rate adjustments for other folks. And they're looking for some kind of recognition that their costs are actually going up. The rates right now under the fee-for-service program, as you know, are about 48% of the 1989 rates, which I don't think anybody can live with right now. And the growth in the number of people on the program and some of the challenges with shifting those costs to other places are making it extremely difficult. And so this is really a response to find some way within the current structure to put some kind of adjustment into the fee-for-service rates for the public programs. It may need some tweaking. It may need some working. We've been talking with the department and staff about this for a while. It may not be something that's perfected, But it's a concept we want to throw out as an idea to try and find ways to keep our providers on the panel, essentially. That's the genesis, and if there are any questions, I'd love to.
Questions for the witness? I guess you're persuasive. Nobody has any questions.
Or it's just late.
Stick with the first one, then. Ms. Coleman, do you want to come down? And I think you are going to testify in support of the bill, then, is that? Maybe not. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Danette Coleman, and I represent Medica and today the Council of Health Plans. And Jim and I actually have had a chance to talk about this a little bit, and I think would be happy to continue having conversations. And I certainly understand the frustration that the providers have in, unfortunately, we have continued to balance the budget by making cuts in provider rates and making cuts to these programs that all of you are very passionate about. And we do not for a second agree that that is how we should be balancing our budget. That being said, looking at this legislation, we have concerns about the approach and the idea that by taking payments from one sector to apply it to another, whether or not that is the solution that we should be looking at. There are also issues of actuarial soundness among payments to plans, whether or not this impacts this or not, but I think it's something that would need to be considered. And then the other thing I would just say is that the issue that is being brought forward here was an issue that we discussed last session. This was a bill that Representative Murphy carried and that actually did become law last year that required a report to go to the legislature on an annual basis that the Department of Human Services would put together that would require information on aggregate provider payment rates that plans make to providers. This report required that each managed care plan provide DHS the percentage and the amount of our capitation payment rates that goes to pay for provider payments to patient care. That had to be broken up into inpatient, outpatient, primary care versus specialty care. It also required that we provided information on the process that insurers use to pass through increases or decreases in provider payment rates that would be mandated by this legislature, and also that we provide a specific information on a methodology that health plans use to determine provider rates. So I don't disagree that there are real issues for the providers here, but I think that we passed legislation last year to begin to look at this problem, and we don't have that report yet to know what solution, if any, should be provided. So thank you,
Ms. Coleman. When's the report coming?
That report was due by statute in December of 2010, and then annually thereafter.
Okay. Questions for Ms. Coleman?
I have a couple for you.
Just last night we were talking about this here, feels like. Was it last night? It's all a big blur. But can you discuss the disparity in PMAP provider rates and fee-for-service provider rates, at least to offer a comment? As I understand, and I haven't looked at my EOBs to compare lately to verify it, but I'm told that the rates under PMAP are higher than in fee-for-service. Can you offer just a general comment about what percent higher and so on?
Mr. Chair, what I can tell you, I think generally the managed care provider reimbursement rates are higher than what the fee-for-service rates are. That is going to vary from health plan to health plan. How the health plans reimburse the providers, whether it's based on RVUs or whether it's based on a percentage of the fee schedule, of the fee-for-service fee schedule, is going to vary. But I can say confidently that all of the plans' reimbursement for managed care is higher than the fee-for-service reimbursement. And Mr. Chair, just to follow up, I think you had asked the question as to the amount. That is going to vary from health plan to health plan as to what percentage above that fee schedule the plans pay.
Would it be 10%, do you think? Is it that high, or is it more than 10%?
I think there are some plans that probably fall higher than 10% and perhaps some that fall around 10%, but I don't think that would be that out of line of an estimate.
I'll have to look it up tomorrow when I go back to work. And I have a Rep. Huntley to your bill. It doesn't say that the PMAP providers have to pay the same rates under your amendment, under your bill. Is that, if you pay them a percent less, if they paid a, if you gave them a percent less and you they paid a percent less, is that okay with you? Ooh, got their attention.
He wants to know what happens to the people, the docs and the people.
Well, let me comment on one thing. When we pulled EOBs from our doctors, some of the health plans rates were actually identical to the fee-for-service plan. And so that's something that we'll have to figure out and work out. But this, and knowing that whether there's a percentage increase or however those rates are figured out, you know, the fee-for-service is a base that's used to figure out whether it's a percentage increase or adjustment or whatever. And so this is really changing that baseline on an annual basis.
Right. I got that part. I'm just pointing out to you that since the health plans make up their rates by contract to you, and the fee-for-service is a fee schedule, there is no official PMAP fee schedule. It's whatever the health plans negotiate. So if they lose a percent, they could say that they lost a percent and pay you a percent less or whatever. So just a caution about what you might get what you asked for. Any other comments on this bill? Anybody else want to testify? No big lineup. Absolutely, you have a closing thought on this?
Well, Mr. Chair, if we don't have a fiscal note yet on this, and if it's it is balanced, but this will be. I would move that it be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
I think we'll do that, and so the bill is laid over
as amended.
Thank you. It's good to have good staff. Which one do you want next, Representative Huntley?
3713. And we, Mr. Chair, I would move House File 3713 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. And we're going to have an amendment to that, but let me just remind you that this is the bill that we discussed last night with George Hoffman and Brian Osberg, and we have some disagreements. This is the one that allows early enrollment in MA. Minnesota is one of 11 states that has this option. And there is, according to Mr. Hoffman, payment rate that the government would do for these new enrollees in medical assistance is adults without kids. And as you may remember, the federal bill will take basically everybody, adults without kids, up to 133% of poverty starting in 2014. The bill has a feature, as I said, that allows 11 states to start this earlier if they choose to do so. And so if Minnesota did that, and we set the adults without kids at home at 75% of poverty, then we would basically cover the same population as in GAMC and about 26,000 people that are on Minnesota Care. And the feds would pay 50% of it. And there's no disagreement that I know of. We might argue over whether it's $50 million in savings or, you know, net and so on. But there is definitely savings in fiscal year 11. And the department thinks that this has large tails, and they are probably right. And I met with the governor on the GAMC bill, and we discussed this with him, and he is interested in trying to get this federal match as long as we don't have the tails problem. And so we're going to have to do some work. The reason this is important and why it says April 1st is when it starts is that the way the federal law is written right now, it's supposed to start on April 1st for those states that want to expand. And we know from Mr. Hoffman and Mr. Greenman that the state can't get this operating that fast. But they did discuss last night about the fact that there may be a look back. And so if we claim that these people are eligible for medical assistance on April 1st, even though we can't process the paperwork for 6 months, we may be able to get a look back. And there, for some of them, we would get the full thing to April 1st. For others, it might be only a three-month look back. But it is important, I think, that if we get the fiscal analysis done, and if it looks like we should say we're starting this on April 1st, that we should do that. And that's the reason I don't want to wait for the omnibus bill. I want to move this to the Finance Committee so it's sitting there. And if we reach an agreement with the governor and we figure out what the feds really mean, we can move that quickly. Again, I'm not interested in having something the governor's going to veto. And so if we don't have an agreement, it'll never get out of the Finance Committee.
And Representative Huntley, to that point, not the veto point, but the look back part, it seems to me from having sat here last night, that was fascinating, I thought, all that discussion. But if we can look back with a program that's uninterrupted, then the whole first quarter of this year could be obtainable as a 50% match. I think if you can argue that April and May with the reduction in whatever amount that's 37% would be the program's still intact but at lower rates, but so it'd be a smaller recoupment. And I think once the program expires at the end of that 2 month transition time, we'd have our new program. I bet that may be what George was talking about. It wouldn't look the same anymore. So a June 1st or a January 1st effective date would give you almost no recoupment. Well, you're a
so okay. That, that's my amendment, and we have an amendment that Representative Murphy is going to offer. And she has an amendment to the amendment.
The A2? Representative Murphy offers the A2 amendment.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. The A2 amendment is a provision that is, we're trying to capture a provision that's also in the federal reform legislation that would provide a federal match for individuals that are in medical assistance with two or more chronic conditions and in a health home. The federal language is health home, but it is a health care home as we know it in Minnesota. And so this amendment is drawn to capture or to mirror what is reflected in the federal legislation so that we may be able to capture extra federal match. And it is lined up very closely with the work that we've already done on the issue of the healthcare home that started back in 2007 and is now through the rulemaking process and actually up and running or beginning to be up and running. So it embraces the reform, it embraces the idea of care coordination, which is something many of us on this committee have supported. And again, it is another way that we may be able to draw down some more federal match. So with that, I'd ask for your support or questions.
And do you also wish to offer the A10-2453 amendment, your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, I would. And this just gives more instruction to the Commissioner of Human Services on the intention of the previous amendment, the A2 amendment.
And you can actually incorporate that into your amendment.
And so I would incorporate this into the A2 amendment.
So let's discuss the amendment. Anybody want to talk about that? Representative Huntley.
We don't have a clear, we just asked for a fiscal note last night, so we don't have it. And again, there may be some difference of opinion between us and the department about what the federal law means, and we're going to have that clarified. I think this is very important that we get this in play and maximize our opportunities to get federal money. But again, I have no intention of having this to be something that would be vetoed. So if we don't have an agreement with the governor that he approves this and we have a good fiscal note on it, then I think we would go ahead. But again, I think there may be some, with this particular one, probably not as much urgency as the previous part of the bill, but still we need to get working on this.
Representative, does the department want to offer a comment about that? Have you just, I don't know who's here to offer a passing comment, or I know it's getting late, but do you want to say something, Mr. Greenman? You've stayed here this late, you might as well get some face time here, you know? You could say it's a work in progress, or do you have anything more than that you want to offer?
Thank you, Matt. The Department of Human Services. We do actually have a preliminary fiscal note done, and it reflects pretty much what was handed out last night by Mr. Hoffman. What I would say about the fiscal note and this process is that we're sort of furious working through the bill and analyzing it as quickly as we can. What the fiscal note reflects is basically our best estimate at this time, with an emphasis on this is our best estimate at this time.
And how about to the amendment? Do you have a comment about that?
Mr. Chair, I think that this would definitely enhance our healthcare home program. It would definitely give us a bigger match on it. I think that the department views the match on this as maybe a little bit more narrowly than Representative Huntley does in terms of what services qualify for the match. I think we're looking at not necessarily as much in the way of underlying medical services that would receive the match, but more or less the care coordination, the making sure people are making a good transition from a long-term care facility to maybe an assisted living facility. Those kinds of services was what we're thinking. But as Representative Huntley said, we need to find from the feds what they're thinking. So.
All right. Well, thank you. And Mr. Hoffman said he could adjust the fiscal note to any day we liked, including April 1st, if he was directed to. And he just made an assumption that this would take a while. And there's a lot of optimists in the room, Mr. Greenman, so I just caution you about that enthusiasm, which may be spreading to the department, they hope so.
At the very least, Mr. Chairman, this would the feds would pay 90% of what we would add on for medical home costs, so that would be wouldn't be as big a plus as some of us might have thought this morning, but it's still a big plus, and we're already doing this, and now we're going to get paid by the feds more for doing it.
And the record should show the department was nodding at that. So, any other discussion about the amendment? Representative Dean?
Mr. Greenman's up there, one of the things I wanted to grab Mr. Hoffman with last night was as we're looking forward in dealing with moving potentially some or all of the population into MA under the 133 and under. Mm-hmm. If we have flexibility to move down from 133 to 75, is there flexibility and benefit set in integrating these people into MA to reduce particularly the tails costs? So if because it's not a benefit set that's currently covered, we wouldn't be obligated under maintenance of effort. So if we can change the eligibility level, can we also change the benefit set of MA or reshape it in some way moving forward?
Mr. Greenman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I think that's one of the questions we have as well from the feds is what exactly is what benefit set would qualify for a match, a federal match under this expansion group. There's certain services that probably need to be covered, and then there are some that may be optional. That's something we still need to try to figure out from the feds, unfortunately.
Is that good? Let's vote on the amendment. Anybody else about the amendment? Let's vote on the amendment. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? That's adopted. And I just have one thought, and I think we're done with this bill almost. In the process of all this negotiation since December or whenever this has been going, there's all this talk about the coordinated care organizations. And I hope that should this go forward, I would think if you could include that somehow, and even just for the hospital portion or something where they're encouraged to coordinate more, if you're allowed to adjust provider rates, and you would adjust the hospital provider rate to some number and do some way to a lump sum it, like 70% or something, and give them the block grant, as it were. I don't know how that would go, but it seems like that would make the, as you're trying to entice a certain individual to be enthusiastic, I think you could preserve what a lot of us liked about that, given enough money to make it work. That would be something worth crowing about. So, anything else? You want to move this out. So all in favor of the bill moving off to an interesting future, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That's done. Well, as amended, excuse me. House File 3047.
Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 3047 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And again, we're trying to get some fiscal notes on this. And as you know, last year, Representative Simon passed a bill that got us in sync with what the feds were saying, and that the feds said that basically in the medical assistance program, if we find fraud in the past, the feds would get their half and we'd get our half back, whatever we collected. Now they give us a 20% bump, so we get basically 70% of the recoveries, and this is an attempt to have someone in the Department of Human Services be in charge of looking for fraud and trying to recollect the items. And when we get a fiscal, again, if there's a positive fiscal note, won't be possibly included.
Representative Peterson.
I just can't resist because, you know, we don't get home till late, and I watch Nightline. And I don't know if any of you do, but about a week ago, there was a special on Nightline. This was in South Florida, I might add. Mm-hmm. But the fraud, I think this was more Medicare than Medicaid, but the Medicare fraud, and the idea that it's just rampant, and they had officers on who said that it is billions of dollars. So I'm thinking, you know, Minnesota certainly doesn't have that kind of fraud going on, I'm sure, but we have the ability to recoup a lot of money for our medical costs if we have that kind of fraud going on, certainly in this country, but even in the state. It was just amazing to listen to the officers, and it was a long special, and really talked a lot about how they do it by buying up small little pharmacies and then paying people to get their prescriptions and to their numbers, and then they write the prescriptions and other things, and they cash in on not only the care but also the pharmaceutical areas. So it was really pretty eye opening and very disturbing, I thought, in terms of the implications of the taxpayers' money being used in this way fraudulently. So I think your bill is wonderful after seeing that program.
Representative Huntley, you've got a glowing endorsement. You might have put one yeah.
No, I was going to say, in many cases, those prescriptions were written by physicians that had been dead for 10 years.
Really? Good work. You can get it. Any other comments to this? Seeing none, the bill's laid over, and we're going to adjourn until the week after Well, April 6th at some time to be determined. 1 p.m. Oh, 1 p.m. April 6th.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're adjourned again.